afternoon and welcome. I'd like to call this meeting of Monday, March 14th of the Joint Senate Transportation Committee and the House Transportation Committee to order.
And
no, we can wait.
Yeah. Okay. Today we're going to roll through the Legislative Auditor's Report and from the Auditor's Office. Mr. Nobles, would you like to come forward, please? Thank you for being here at the committee. We appreciate your time. Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, do you have any comments before we start?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to echo my thanks to the legislative auditor and the auditor's office, all of the auditors and legislative and for taking on this project and presenting it to us today. I'll just say by way of background that I need to tip my hat to Senator Senjum, who's been asking this question repeatedly year in and year out. So here we are, Senator Senjum. Just to, as we jokingly say, where is the secret room? Let's open up the black box. How do these projects get picked, and how do we understand them a little better? So we're looking forward to the information you have to present.
Thank you. Mr. Nobles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Joint Committee. For the record, my name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and with me at the table is David Kirchner, who is the manager of our evaluation. And Mr. Chair, shall I do both Mr. Chair and Mr. Chair, or just one Mr. Chair?
Just one Mr. Chair. We're just kind of hanging on. We're just hanging around these parts today. We're invited guests.
We took this on because you asked us to, and we go through a topic selection process. As you know, we're going through it again. And so we want to be responsive to your needs and the issues that you have. And Senator Senjum, you're not alone. There were many people who asked us to look inside the black box, see what goes on, or what goes on in that big gray building next door, and how do they make the selections for highway projects. And I hope that this report enlightens you. I think it is a good thing that in this state we have a long and strong tradition of really relying a great deal on the professionals at the Department of Transportation to help the state, to help you pick projects for preservation, for improvement. And that is a good thing because it keeps us out of some of the controversies that have occurred in Washington and in some states of earmarking projects simply by some kind of a political process. So it is a good thing, but what you have to have when you turn these things over to the people in the big gray building is more transparency. There is a lot of concern, I think, about the criteria, the process by which projects are selected or not selected. And that's why you asked for this report. And so I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Kirchner to tell you what we found and what we recommend. And again, to both of you and all of you, thank you for being here. We look forward to presenting the report and answering your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Noble. Mr. Kirchner, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Kirchner. I was the evaluation manager for this audit. Before I get started, I want to thank my colleagues, Ryan Moltz and Catherine Tyson, who are behind me here, whose hard work is also represented in the presentation I'm going to make today. So to start off with, I'd like to just give you a quick overview of where we're headed, of the kind of the key findings that we had. MnDOT does not have one project selection process. It has more than one. It has multiple project selection processes. There is a standard process, and we found generally that the projects that are selected through that standard process are consistent with MnDOT's stated priorities, although the process itself is not very transparent, and we think MnDOT can do something to improve transparency. But there are a number of alternative processes as well. Those processes produce projects that are not always consistent with MnDOT's stated priorities. And in particular, I'll call out here that we think there's a little bit of an overemphasis on projects that can be constructed or that can start construction quickly. And in particular, we had some concerns with the corridors of commerce process, and we think that MnDOT should make some changes to that process. Let me start off with a little bit of background, and first to be clear about what it is that we looked at. You can think about the framework of how a project gets built, starting off with broad planning and broad goals, and then the selection of projects, and then the actual construction. And we looked in the that middle box there, just at how MnDOT decides to do what projects it does. We did not look as closely at the planning process, and we did not look much at the construction end of things. MnDOT builds construction projects to replace or rehabilitate or build new sections of trunk highways. And there are, if you like, two types of projects, preservation projects and expansion projects. A preservation project, at the end of that project, you have the same amount of infrastructure that you had there before. So even if it's a big bridge replacement project, millions of dollars in multiple years, it's still a preservation project if at the end of the day you have the same number of lines going across the river that you had before. Whereas an expansion project is where you have new infrastructure at the end of the project, even if it's something very small, like a turn lane that wasn't there before, that's an expansion project. And projects often have both preservation and expansion elements. And I want to note that we did not look a whole lot at the maintenance, preventive maintenance side of things. We looked primarily at the construction projects funded out of the state road construction budget. There are not that many legal requirements with regard to how MnDOT chooses projects. There are some vague things in state law, but generally speaking, the legislature has given MnDOT a lot of discretion for how it chooses what projects to do. There are some requirements in the federal MAP 21 law that was passed in 2012. And in particular, MnDOT and all the other states are required to pay particular attention to the national highway system, which is a subset of Minnesota's trunk highways. In the report on page 4, there is a map that shows all of Minnesota's trunk highways and highlights the ones that are on the national highway system. And as you will see from that map, the national highway system roads are the most traveled roads in the state. It's all of the interstates, and it's most of the major inner city connector roads. So generally speaking, although it's not always the case, but generally speaking, national highway system roads are the most traveled roads. And under MAP 21, the state needs to pay particular attention to making sure that those roads stay in good shape. However, many of the MAP 21 rules, even though the law was passed in 2012, many of those rules are still going through the federal rulemaking process and have not been put forward. So exactly what MnDOT or what the other states have to do to fulfill those federal requirements is still a little unclear. I'll start off by talking about the standard process. And that process changed in 2013, partly as a result of the passage of MAP 21. And right now we're kind of in a little in-between place because MnDOT plans projects many years ahead of when it actually builds them. So even though MnDOT started this new process of how it chooses projects in 2013, none of those projects have been built yet. The first projects that will be built under the new process will be built starting in 2017. Under the new process, districts choose projects, which is what happened in the past, but they are now constrained by a number of limits that are placed on them by the central office. They have to meet particular performance targets. They have to show that the projects that they're building will produce a certain level of performance in terms of pavement smoothness, in terms of bridge structure, and so forth. And they have specific spending guidelines that they have to follow. I don't want to get into too much detail about the performance targets, but I will note that we have them in the report on page 19, and if you'd like to look at them, they're listed there. But I do want to talk just a little bit about the spending targets. I have a broad overview of them listed here on the slide. A more detailed listing of the spending targets is on page 29 of the report. As you can see from these targets, and these are from the 20-year State Highway Investment Plan, MnDOT plans to spend most of its state road construction money on preservation types projects in which there is not any new infrastructure being put into place. And there are two different sets of targets, those for the first 10 years, for 2014 through 2023, and those for the second 10 years between 2024 and 2033. And as you can see, in the second 10 years, there is an even larger emphasis on preservation projects and practically no money being put toward expansion. There's not very much money being put toward expansion now. It's mostly in the metropolitan area to deal with congestion issues, but there's no money in the 20-year highway plan for expansion after 2024. Some broad overall features of the standard process. I'm not going to walk through the whole thing because it would take me a very long time. It took us a long time to figure it out. We do have a very detailed overview of how that process works in Chapter 2 of the report. But to broadly say a few things about the standard process. MnDOT, we found, is directing funds to its stated priorities. It says it's trying to do primarily preservation, and that is, in fact, where the money is being directed. Another feature of the standard process is that pavement and bridge preservation needs, or identified needs, I should say, drive everything else. MnDOT decides first what it's going to do with regard to pavement preservation and what it's going to do with regard to bridge preservation. And then it fits in all of the other work it's doing around those particular projects that it has already selected. So those preservation projects are put into place first. I lost my train of thought. I wanted to cite one example, which is on Interstate 35E, just north of St. Paul here. As many of you probably know, MnDOT built MnPass lanes on that road this past year. And MnDOT could have put MnPass lanes in a number of corridors that would have been high priorities, but it particularly chose to put them there because it was already going to be doing a major bridge construction project along that road. And so it put those MnPass lanes there in order to combine together projects for cost efficiencies. But the thing to emphasize is that those preservation projects are chosen first. The other thing to say about the standard process is that it is still MnDOT districts who are making the key choices. It is MnDOT districts that decide what projects to build and what is included in a project. The extent of oversight by the central office is primarily about the program as a whole. How does all the district's choices, when put together, meet the performance targets, meet the spending targets? So there's very little evaluation at the central office level of individual projects. As Mr. Noble said, we have some concerns about the transparency of this process. In part, that's why you asked us to do this evaluation. Projects are chosen primarily internally. There's a lot of conversations within MnDOT offices between engineers and planners. And there's little direct involvement by stakeholders in how projects are chosen. There are opportunities for local stakeholders and members of the public to offer input to MnDOT, but it's sometimes to those stakeholders not clear what happens to that input once they've given it. And there's not a whole lot of information that is provided to many stakeholders about exactly how the projects were chosen. In particular, we wanted to highlight that we think that MnDOT doesn't do a whole lot in saying what it decides not to do. And that we think, as a form of transparency, it's much clearer and more transparent process if you can compare, here's something that they did decide to do, here's something they didn't decide to do, here are the criteria that this project met and this other project didn't meet. But MnDOT primarily, in its published material, talks about what it does decide to do. And so there's a lack of clarity, if you will, about the projects that are on the bubble and which ones get selected and which ones don't. So we have a broad recommendation that MnDOT take steps to improve transparency in that standard decision-making process, that standard project selection process. Let me turn to the alternative processes that I spoke about before. We talk about a number of them in the report. I'm not going to go through all of them in detail. There are specialty programs that are run out of the MnDOT central office. This includes Corridors of Commerce, TED, the Transportation and Economic Development Program, other programs. MnDOT leadership does make some choices directly about what projects to do. In addition, we took as our sphere of what we looked at What happens on trunk highways, not necessarily what MnDOT does on trunk highways. And we observed that there are local jurisdictions that are building projects on trunk highways as well as MnDOT. And we thought that that was of interest. And then there are instances in which lawmakers choose projects. Although the federal government, the Congress has stopped doing as much in the way of earmarking, there are still a few leftover earmarked projects that MnDOT is still completing. And there are occasional projects in bonding bills that that select particular projects. Usually, the money is given to local units of government to do those projects, not to MnDOT, but they are on trunk highways. Again, a broad overview of these alternative processes. First of all, I want to say that there's much less money in these processes than in the standard process. The amount of money varies from year to year. We have in the report on page 54, we have a listing of some of these projects and the amounts of money that have gone to them over the past few years. And as those of you who know the state road construction amount know that these amounts are fairly small compared to the overall amount. These projects tend to not be decided at the district level. They're decided by the central office or, as in the case of the locally led projects, outside of MnDOT altogether. Some use a competitive application process to select projects. And in many instances, that competitive process prioritizes project readiness, how soon a project can start construction. Each one of these processes has its own set of selection criteria. And generally speaking, these different alternative processes try to move projects forward that would not be brought forward through MnDOT's standard process. So to some extent, they are circumventing MnDOT's stated preference for primarily preservation projects by bringing other projects forward. I said I wanted to talk particularly about corridors of commerce because we had some concerns. Some background: corridors of commerce funds expansion projects that address gaps in the trunk highway system. That might be a four-lane road that goes down to a two-lane road and then back up to a four-lane road a little later, or a place where two trunk highways do not connect up very well. Or it can also be projects, either preservation or expansion projects, that improve freight movement. The law, which was passed in 2013, requires that MnDOT evaluate suggestions for corridors of commerce that it receives from the public, and that it use specific criteria to choose those projects, and those criteria are listed in the law. The amount of funding that the legislature has directed toward corridors of commerce has fluctuated quite a lot. The first year, there was $300 million allocated toward the program in bonding funds. The second year, $6.5 million. The third year, $20 million. So there's been a substantial change from year to year in the amount of money put toward this program. As I said, we had some concerns with the corridors of commerce selection process. We found that MnDOT, although it did accept public suggestions through a website and through other avenues, we found it didn't actually really evaluate those. It took suggestions from within MnDOT, and it evaluated the suggestions it received from within MnDOT, but it pretty much discarded any suggestions that it received from the public that did not match up to internally suggested projects. MnDOT used some, but not all, of the criteria that were specifically listed in the law, and MnDOT added its own criteria for choosing the projects. MnDOT, even after choosing its own criteria, did not choose the projects that scored the highest on its criteria. And in at least one instance, MnDOT leadership inserted kind of its own preferred projects very, very late in the selection process at the meeting at which the final decisions were made, or at least I should say the final recommendation was put together that went to the commissioner. So we have some recommendations for MnDOT and the legislature with regard to corridors of commerce. We think MnDOT needs to align its selection process and its criteria with the law, and we suggest that the legislature put in place some greater oversight of the corridors of commerce process. We think that the legislature should require MnDOT to report a detailed description of the criteria it uses and how those criteria are measured. and that MnDOT be required to report to the legislature a ranking of all of the projects selected to it and how they ranked on those criteria. As I said, MnDOT leadership does do some direct selection of projects. And in particular, we paid attention to what's called the TPIC committee, the Transportation Program and Investment Committee, a very senior committee within MnDOT whose voting members are the two deputy commissioners, the five division directors, and the Metro District engineer. Now, TPIC recommends all projects, actually, to the commissioner. That is, all of the projects that go through the standard process, all the projects that come out of corridors of commerce, transportation, economic development, and so forth, they come to TPIC for final approval and recommendation to the commissioner. But TPIC, we thought was important to point out, also serves as something of a clearinghouse for unplanned funds and unplanned needs. So when things arise that are not in MnDOT's plans, they come to TPIC, and TPIC may identify that as a need that needs to be addressed. For example, when it became clear that MnDOT was going to have to move Highway 53 in order to go around a planned mine, that was a problem that came to TPIC. Oh, here's some money that we're going to need to figure out where it's going to come from. There are also instances where additional funding comes in. Sometimes MnDOT, for example, knows it's going to receive additional federal funds but doesn't know how much. And then so it can't especially plan for those until those federal funds come in. Another example would be last year, the legislature appropriated an additional $134 million out of the trunk highway balance to the state road construction budget, and that it was TPIC that decided what projects those funds were going to be spent on. As I said, local governments do build stuff on trunk highways, on the highways that are ordinarily under MnDOT's jurisdiction. They usually assemble funding from a variety of sources, state, federal, local sources. MnDOT sometimes, but not always, contributes funding to these projects, so of course MnDOT has to approve whenever this occurs. And we wanted to provide to you a listing of these projects and an idea of how much money is being spent by local governments. And frankly, we were surprised to find out that we were unable to get that from MnDOT. In order to assemble that kind of a list, we would have had to contact every local government and ask them if they had done such a project and how much they had spent on it. We did not do that, but we think that MnDOT ought to be tracking how much local governments are spending on trunk highways and providing that information to you as an important part of your understanding of how much money is spent to maintain and to upgrade our trunk highway system. We had some overall concerns about these various alternative processes. We felt that the emphasis on project readiness might not always choose the best projects or might be put some possible projects that are important at a disadvantage. One example of those types of projects, there are many cities in outstate Minnesota that have who have main streets in their cities that are trunk highways as well, and MnDOT is responsible for upgrading those highways. And those cities are very interested in having those streets rehabilitated or reconstructed because they want to get to the sewer and water infrastructure underneath. So those are very important projects, those local stakeholders. But that kind of coordination between state and local government requires more time. So those projects are going to be, even though they're of great interest, are going to be disadvantaged by processes that focus on what can start construction the quickest. Also, projects that are started quickly can cost more. We heard from most MnDOT districts that when they had to do projects in a short period of time, they often had to hire consultants to help manage those projects because they weren't able to do it with their available staff. Additionally, we found that MnDOT basically is reinventing new selection processes with each one of these alternative programs that get put into place. So with the various programs that we look at in the report, the Safety Mobility Interchange Program, Transportation Economic Development, Corridors of Commerce, each one has a separate set of criteria. Each one has a separate set of a separate process and sometimes decided by different people. And there's no overall prioritization process for expansion projects in that don't fit within the long-range planning. MnDOT does its planning and its long-term programming based upon the money it expects to have available. And so because it does not expect to have money available for these type of expansion projects, it doesn't plan them. But then that means that each time that money does become available, either through one process or another, that a new set of criteria gets put together. And we think MnDOT could do more to put together a planning process that thinks more long-term, even though it's not tied to money that it expects to have available. So two recommendations here to conclude. We think that the legislature should, and MnDOT both, should limit the use of project readiness as a criterion in any type of program that's put forward. And project criterionness should only be used as a criterion when it actually is important to build the project quickly for some particular reason. Second, we think that MnDOT, as I said, should develop a transparent, long-term planning and prioritization process for expansion projects that are funded through these various alternative processes so that there is a clearer idea of what would be at the top of the list when these new types of processes are put into place. And with that, Mr. Chair, I am done with my presentation. I will be more than happy to take questions from members.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, Mr. Nobles. We certainly do have a few questions as they come in. I just want to thank you for the review. I know that it doesn't show the countless hours that you and your staff have put into this, and we appreciate that. And certainly just at first blush, I would say that it's a criticism that all of us in the legislature need to accept and take, because I think historically from the transportation perspective, we've tried not to micromanage our departments, and but we also understand that accountability is extremely important. And as this report is showing, we need to take a look every once in a while at those processes, and we thank you for doing that. So with that, we'll go to questions. Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to talk a little bit about corridors of commerce, and particularly in the context of the alternative, because that would be one of the alternative processes. And you point out that each process has different selection criteria, which immediately, and I'm my comments now are directed at us and not at MnDOT, because we've probably been part of that, and we certainly did that with corridors of commerce. And what I see in your, you know, the blue pages when you talk about it, the legislature created the corridors of commerce to fund, etc. Funding has fluctuated dramatically. The legislature appropriated $300 million in 2013, 6.5 in 2014, 25 in 2015. So we did all this. But we didn't get rid of anything else. So we layered on a new program and a new way of distributing money and new selection criteria but we didn't get rid of anything else. And I try to imagine from a management perspective how you could quickly respond to something like that, particularly with those dramatic changes in funding, how you could plan for $300 million 1 year and 6.5 another year, but still be bound by those selection criteria. And that's what we've done. We've layered that over everything else without getting rid of it, of something else. And I'm just wondering if that factored in at all as you evaluated MnDOT, and how that's even possible, how it's possible to do.
Mr. Kircher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Hausman. It's a very good question. I think that MnDOT did have some difficulty with the fluctuating amount of funding available. But I think that is also a characteristic of transportation programming overall, is that the amount of funding that is available has fluctuated and probably will continue to fluctuate. And there are things that are expected and things that are not expected. And that's part of the idea of our last recommendation that I spoke about in the presentation, is to try and do some planning ahead so that there is a sense of what is going to be kind of top of the list if funding does become available, and not to create the criteria each time through.
And then, Mr. Chair, if I could just follow up specifically this on your features of alternative processes. Each process has different selection criteria. Did you ever make any summary judgment about that? If that's true, each process has different selection criteria. Isn't that part of an almost impossible management structure that we're putting in place, that we're putting in place?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if it is impossible, but it is certainly difficult, I think, is the best answer I can give you. I agree with you. I think it presents challenges to MnDOT when there are a variety of different legislative programs that have different legislative criteria that it is trying to manage.
Representative Uglum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to zero in on one of your recommendations in the alternative processes, where you say that the legislature and MnDOT should limit the use of project readiness as a selection criteria. And when you say limit the use, I'm questioning with inflation construction costs the way they are today, and when local units of government may do pre-engineering, which is going to save MnDOT money, and have essentially a shovel-ready project ready to go, why should we limit those efficiencies?
Mr. Kircher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative. I think that's a great question, and I think what I would argue there is that you've identified what is a good criteria to use there, and that is it'll cost less. I like that criteria. That's a good criteria. In other words, it's not about... It shouldn't be necessarily based upon what can start soon, but if we are looking at two comparable projects and one of them costs less because it can start earlier, well, that's a reasonable criteria. But just because it can start soon doesn't all by itself necessarily, I think, make it a better project. So I agree with what you're saying, but I think I would flip it around and say that the criteria that you're talking about is cost, and that, I think, is a very reasonable criteria for MnDOT to use.
Okay. Thank you for your clarification.
Representative Hurt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You say in the MnDOT does not track the number, extent, or cost of locally trunk highway projects. Is there any reason that we are not keeping track of what the cities are spending on their local roads? I don't think we're doing that, and that means that spending is driven out of property taxes, and it's a factor that we should know about because the cities are having a heck of a time maintaining their and they're not maintaining their streets and so forth. So is there any reason why we don't suggest that there ought to be a central repository of the information that how much the cities are spending?
Mr. Kirchner, I believe you suggested that, but...
Well, I think what I would say to you, Representative Earhart, is that our scope on this project was really focused on what happens on trunk highways. And so from that point of view, we did not look closely at what happens on local roads, and we do not have any recommendations that are addressed to what happens on local roads for that reason. It's just a matter of the scope of what we looked at. But I will say that local units of government are sometimes choosing to spend money that they otherwise could spend on local roads on trunk highways, and I think that's important and worth paying attention to, and that the legislature should be able to have a sense of how big of a chunk of money that is. And I don't think, I'm sorry, I can't provide that to you, and I think I should have been able to.
Just to clarify, Mr. Kircher, that was one of your suggestions, is that we should be asking for that. We should be getting that information, what the locals are spending.
Absolutely, but if I understood Representative Earhart's question correctly, he was suggesting that MnDOT should also track what local units of government spend on local roads. And what I was saying is that we really confined our recommendations to stuff that happens on trunk highways.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this report. It's nice to get some information and confirm the concern about transparency and public engagement, and then actually what is done with that public engagement when it's collected. So I thank you for that. And I think one of the things that we need to explore more is you started with the MnShip, what MnDOT wants to do. I'm very interested in how MnShip connects with the goals that are in statute, federal and state laws, civil rights laws, so that we know we're starting from a framework that's not flawed. And I'm not saying that Midship is flawed, but I'm saying we really need to make sure that we're tying it to that. Now, this is really important in our state when we have the biggest disparity gaps in the country in transportation. I've been talking about it for a while, and now we're getting reports and studies out, even for our own demographer, that transportation is one of the biggest contributing factors to disparities in the state. So when MnDOT, I know we had met earlier, and that you had mentioned, I'd like you to explore this a little bit more, about MnDOT's civil rights program, environmental justice program, and I'll let you say what you had told me. But when you don't have that built in the program from the start, then your projects aren't necessarily meeting the needs of Minnesotans, whether it's an elderly person or whether it's a young person, it's a millennial, really starting with a framework of what we want to achieve. And so that I wanted to mention that, but then also I'd hope we're able to delve into eventually is not only project selection, but how does a project actually turn out? What are we measuring performance on? How are we knowing that it's meeting the needs of the people of Minnesota and our state goals? So what I'd just like you to comment on is how we're doing to making sure we're meeting the needs of people through upholding people's civil rights and environmental justice in our transportation system, because it doesn't just come with the community engagement at the end, and we've already found out in this report that it tends not to be listened to anyway. So how do we get that up front in the front process so we're building a transportation system that really helps people have economic prosperity now and in the future for everyone in Minnesota?
Yep. Mr. Chair. Mr. Kirshner, if you could help us clarify the various IPs before you answer Representative Bernard's questions. Is the STIP and the CHIP, the MNCHIP? Thanks.
Mr. Kirshner. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So once again, the MNCHIP is the 20-year state highway investment plan that is what's being referred to. Actually, if I could, Mr. Chair, and Representative Bernardi, let me start off with a different one of your questions, and then I'll kind of try and pivot around to that other one, because I appreciate very much the question about how MnDOT pays attention to various disadvantaged communities. That's something that we looked at in the report, but I can't always put everything into the presentation, and so I'm happy to talk about that piece of it as well. MnDOT is required by various federal and state laws to pay attention to those communities and how it does its work. And what we found is that is not at all a part of the project selection process. To the extent that MnDOT pays attention to those things, it pays attention to those issues after the project is selected. Once a project is selected, then it decides how it needs to address the particular accessibility needs or the particular needs of communities in poverty or the particular needs of older Minnesotans in that area where that project is occurring. But MnDOT does not pay attention to those issues in how it chooses the projects itself, and we thought that was noteworthy to point out. So I appreciate your asking the question so I could bring that up as well, because I didn't fit that into the presentation. With regard to the MnCHIP, the 20-year state highway investment plan, I think that our feeling about that plan is there may be, and I think there were many people who had concerns about exactly what the criteria were, or the spending targets were in that plan. I do think that MnDOT has been very public about what those spending targets are, and it is stated these are the percentages of money that we're going to put toward these things. What I can report to you is that it is in fact following through on those spending criteria. So if you have concerns about the spending criteria, then those are good concerns to have, because that's actually what MnDOT is following. When we gave our report to the legislature in 2008 after the collapse of the Interstate 35W bridge, one of the things that we found at that time was that MnDOT was not necessarily putting its money where it said its priorities were. And so we're happy to report the change that now it is putting the money toward where its priorities are. And that, I think, is a good thing, and that we can have a transparent debate over what the categories are in the MnCHIP. And then I think the last question, Representative Bernardi, that you had to do with performance measures. And I do think what I would say is that, go back to what I said earlier about how pavement and bridge drives everything else. So that is, that's, those are the key performance measures. How smooth the pavement is, how good a structure the bridge is, that is what kind of drives what gets done. And if you have an interest in a bicycle project or a pedestrian project, or you need a culvert repaired or any of those things, those are going to be things that are going to get swept into a larger pavement or bridge project. It's pavement and bridges that get decided first, and other things get brought in as they fit in around those things. So I hope I answered all the various things that you had, Representative Bernardi.
And Mr. Chair, just one follow-up.
Representative Bernardi.
Thank you. And I just want to put a plug in for the bill that I have regarding that a lot of us have come together, Democrats and Republicans, for doing performance measures so that we are actually measuring the outcomes that we want our transportation system to produce, and in collaboration with the public and very transparent. So I think that's a way that we could move forward together to be as efficient and effective as possible with our resources.
Thank you. Mr. Kirchner, since you brought this up, just as in regards to pavement condition and what drives those projects, when in your report, there was an example that one district was far outperforming another district from a standpoint from 90% down to 49%. So what's the issue if we're looking at the statewide plan that we can go from district to district and be that much disparity?
I think I'm going to suggest that you ask MnDOT that question. I think that that's not something that I'm able to shed a whole lot of light on. As I said, we focused very specifically on how MnDOT chooses what it's going to do. And as far as those outcomes, why it is that we have those disparities, that I have less, I feel less confident in talking about, especially since, as I pointed out at the beginning of the report, the process that we're evaluating, no projects have been done yet based upon that process that we described to you. So the outcomes that you're talking about, where districts are very far apart in terms of where they were on the pavement measures, those had to do with the projects chosen under the previous process, where districts pretty much had even much more autonomy than they do now. So I'll suggest that MnDOT, I'd like to hear MnDOT's answer to that question.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for the report. I live in Nicollet County, and therefore Highway 14 is exceedingly important. And the question that my neighbors are always asking, why can't Highway 14 ever rise on the in this what you call the standard among the standard processes for prioritizing roads? I think I could take a survey up and down Highway 14, and I the numbers would be astronomical in saying this has to be a priority. And frankly, I think the state knows it. So my question is, did you investigate that? Why doesn't a highway like Highway 14, the expansion to four lanes, ever rise under the standard processes?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the blunt answer is that MnDOT's overall priorities are to maintain what currently exists and not to build things that are new. That is what it is stated, and that is what it is trying to do. The ways in which work has been done recently on Highway 14 have been through these alternative processes, like corridors of commerce, that have brought some of these other things that are very much valued by stakeholders forward. And so there is something, I think, to be said for those processes. But it is certainly the case that they go around what MnDOT says it's trying to do. What MnDOT says it's trying to do, and I think the standard process bears that out, is they are trying to maintain what they've got. And that is, we found that is essentially what they are, what that current selection process is doing on the standard side.
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my question revolves around that as well. I participated in some meetings in the district before I ran for office, before I was elected, and the MnDOT had done a survey of everybody. What is it that you want us to focus on? and overwhelmingly there were differences between different parts of the state. And in my particular area, we needed expansion. So I sat in the meeting, and what they said was, here's what you voted, here's why we're going to do what we want to anyway. Here's what we want, here's why we're going to do what we want to anyway. So your recommendation number one that says that they should increase the transparency and decision-making process, I'm concerned what exactly that entails and means, because they were very transparent with us at that time. They allowed us to vote, they gave a good conversation about what it was, and then explained to us why they weren't going to do that. So can you talk a little bit about how does just telling them to come up with a transparency process will in fact get the outcome that I'm looking for, that I think several of us have been talking about, that we came up with these alternatives because it wasn't what we wanted?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I think that one of the things that is important about transparency, at least from our point of view, is that that provides you with an understanding of what it is that MnDOT's going to do, and then you, as a legislature, have the power to change that, and can say to MnDOT, we want you to do something different. If you know what it is that they're doing in the first place, if you don't know what it is that they're doing in the first place, it makes it harder as the legislature to suggest that there be something different.
Sure. Mr. Chair.
Okay. If I could respond to that, and we can get into this discussion a little bit more later with the Department of Transportation, but I think we need to hold kind of two thoughts in our minds that aren't necessarily in conflict with each other, but they appear to be. I think what we're struggling with as a legislature is transparency, fully understanding the objective criteria that MnDOT uses, particularly in the standard project selection process. So kind of opening up the black box or finding the secret room. And also allowing for some input, some conversation into that process. But also having some understanding that they're not going to allow themselves to be subjected to undue influence or pressure based on, you know, a powerful legislator or a mobilized constituency or something like that, because that then would mean that a lot of projects in other parts of the state which might meet those objective tests would just go wanting forever and ever. And that's part of why we developed corridors of commerce in the first place, to have a competitive kind of a subset, a smaller sum of money, competitive, set off to the side, to rank projects based on, and particularly expansion projects, these, you know, corridors of commerce, or as the name implies, trying to connect our regional centers and try to create these economic routes that support economic potential throughout the state, so that things like Highway 23, Highway 14, others that need expansion, that need safety improvements, that sort of thing, that might not ever get to the top of the standard process list, have some crack at getting some funds to do what needs to be done. So we're trying to strike a balance, I think, in some of the recent programs we've developed. Transparency in all cases, an opportunity for input, but also some ability to understand that an objective analysis will be followed in the standard project selection process, but then allowing some avenue and opportunity for these other aspirations that we have.
Mr. Chair? Mr. Chair?
Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Dibble, I was talking about, too, I want people to understand, I wasn't talking about a list of projects at the time. They were asking us, do you want to preserve existing infrastructure or expand? What do you want us to focus on? So that's what I'm referring to, is we were given the opportunity to let them know what we wanted them to focus on, not by project, but overall. So that was the survey where they said, well, we understand you out here would like this expanded, but we're going to concentrate on the preservation side. And that's kind of where I was going and want to get a better understanding of how does the legislature participate, you know, how does the local and how does the legislature participate in that selection, just like Representative Bernardi was talking about, some of those goals that we want. How do we reflect that to MnDOT? So thank you.
Thank you. Senator Champion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have a couple questions, and if the second question is outside the bounds, you can tell me that, right? So consistent with looking at the MNSHIP and the 20-year state highway investment plan, one of the things that I believe that I heard you say is that as a part of the analysis, that they are not analyzing the needs of seniors and communities of color and how it chooses this project. So I'd like to know what the response was to that, and why they're not doing that, and what did they say about that. But but in addition to that, my second question really revolves around one recommendation is for MnDOT to track local government spending on trunk highways. And so with this in mind around spending and construction projects, did you evaluate MnDOT's spend with disadvantaged business enterprises and the potential impact the potential negative impact inconsistent operations will have on minority-owned businesses?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question. I will admit that we did not look at the second part of your question at all. That wasn't within the scope of our report. Although our office, I believe, has participated and been aware of some of the internal MnDOT audit work of the of the DBE program, the Disadvantaged Business Enterprise Program, and I don't know if Jim Nobles wants to talk about that at all. But as far as the first question goes, they did not directly respond to that in the letter, so I will defer to some extent that question to MnDOT in terms of how they are reacting to that finding of ours since the release of the report. What I can tell you is that when we were going and speaking with folks in various local in various districts and asking MnDOT engineers and planners how they made their selections. And then we would say, all right, there's this list of things in the front of the STIP, which is the state, it's the four-year plan. I forget what that stands for, but it's the four-year plan for what projects are going to be done. There's a list of things that says this plan does meet the requirements of the Older Americans Act, of the Executive Order on Environmental Justice, of the Executive Order on People with Limited English Proficiency, of the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. There's about 8 or 9 of them, and so forth. And we would ask, how do you meet these requirements in the process of selecting projects? And the answer was pretty much always confusion. That they did not see that as being part of how as something that played a role in the decision making process. That they said always, well, that's something that comes in later. That comes in after we've decided what we're doing. Then we start addressing those types of issues. Once we've decided that we're going to be in a particular community, then we start looking at what the public outreach is going to be like, how we're going to be accessible, and so forth. So to the extent that any of these things were looked at, it's only in regard to the broad types of planning processes that Senator Jensen was talking about, to the extent that those are made accessible to people with various types of disabilities or are held in various communities to make it easier for people to get to.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I can just very briefly respond to the other part of the question about the DBE program. We did, and Senator Champion, you may remember, and I know Senator Dibble had concerns about that program. It was, when we did some work, it was frankly in a state of some management disarray. And I think the commissioner may want to speak to that as well. I mean, his challenge at the time was simply to stabilize it because of the internal problems. But it has been a topic that's been on our list, the long list, to do a deeper evaluation. But it, among all of the other ones that is on there, it simply has not emerged. But it's something that we would certainly be interested in working with you and others that are interested to at least just monitor some of the changes that I know the commissioner has been trying to make in that office, in the Office of Civil Rights, and for that program.
Senator Champion.
Thank you, and I hope that we really do take a look at that and ask for some additional evaluation of MnDOT around the DBE program, but also around this very critical question, and I can't wait for the commissioner to come up so that we can ask about that mentorship criteria and why they're not looking at the needs of seniors and communities of color and how it chooses its projects, because there was a study that came out that just said that a contributing factor to poverty is the amount of time it takes for people in those communities to get to certain locations, be it a job, be it anything else, or travel times. And so there's some additional work that I'd like for us to take a look at around that, is because if we're really serious about eliminating poverty, then we should definitely do our work around the spend, and we should do our work around analyzing how projects are selected and how it impacts communities of color and seniors.
Thank you. Mr. Kirchner, I'd like to direct you to page 57 of your report. I'm sure you know what it is, because we're really focusing on criteria and the selection process and how this is all playing out. And one of the more confusing items, as I look at it, is the Corridors of Commerce programs, where we have a list of probably the top 30 projects. And we see a ranking here, but when we look at the actual projects selected, it looks like we go 2, 3, 4, maybe 7, 8, then we go down to 17, 18. What is your assessment and your overall take on this specific Corridors of Commerce selection process, and what has transpired here? What are we missing where we put a list of prioritized projects and yet the selection is all over the board?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think I draw the same conclusions you do, that it's it's not a very transparent process, and it's a process that it has to some extent been done in a very subjective manner, that preferences are being expressed within MnDOT for certain types of projects, and those preferences are carrying the day, despite the fact that the ranking that its own staff put together didn't rank the projects in that order.
Okay. I think maybe that'll be a question later on. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm finding some of these recommendations intriguing, especially about MnDOT tracking the and reporting local spending. Now, I represent two communities in Dakota County. And I remember when I first got in the city council, I met with one of my businesses, and they had over 7,000 employees, and they wanted something, an upgrade to the roads near them, and were told by MnDOT that they needed to wait another 20 years, and essentially that's kind of what happened. And I know that as a city we would put money up front to get roads done just because they needed to be done. And then also within Dakota County, we have very few state highways. Almost all of our major roadways are county. So my question is, if these recommendations were followed, do you think that MnDOT would be able to accomplish more? Or is maybe the issue that they have been trying to deal with so many issues and not having adequate funding, and this is why some of this is happening. Is that clear? Am I clear?
Mr. Kirchner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you for the question, Representative. I think that certainly MnDOT would say that they could do more if they had more funding. I think the recommendation with regard to tracking is not so much so that more could be done, but simply so that we would have a better understanding of what currently is being done. I think that it seems to me, and seemed to us on our team, that this was an important part of the story. If we're going to be talking about a state resource, the trunk highway system, and we're going to talk about how much it costs to maintain and to occasionally improve it, then we need to know about all of the spending that takes place, not just the spending that is directed by MnDOT. And it felt to us like an important part of the story that was just not being told, and we think that it should be told, and that should be information that's available to you as you think about these important funding types of questions. Because if what you look at is just how much money has MnDOT spent over the past few years, and you draw conclusions based on that, oh, they need this much more money, or they need that much more money, but you're not looking at the total amount of money that's actually been spent on the system, you're not going to have a complete picture, and you might not make the decisions that you you might make different decisions than you would otherwise.
Okay, thank you. I'll add one more thing. In Eagan, and this goes back about 20 years, for local businesses to get onto Highway 13 was major. But we did manage to do a cooperative venture with the state, with a, you know, just a whole lot of entities to get that redone. So that worked. So I know it's possible to, through cooperation or partnerships, to get things done in a much sooner schedule than sometimes you see. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, we have three more members with questions specifically of the report, and then I think we'll move on and we'll allow MnDOT to come down to talk with us. So, Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks to Mr. Nobles and your entire staff. Really did a great job on this, so I appreciate it. I was especially interested in the fact that you referenced the public and stakeholder process in the Corridors of Commerce program. And that was important to us when we wrote this law, that there be this give and take between MnDOT and local and public stakeholders, because quite frankly, that's actually a very important value. And where did you feel this broke down? Was it because the public was and the local stakeholders were suggesting ideas and projects that didn't meet criteria, or was it just something maybe in the culture that these ideas were discarded? I was very interested in your conclusions about that.
Mr. Kircher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hornstein. I think that there are a couple of different pieces to why that might have happened, and I'm going to I'll advertise here that I'm going to do some speculation here because I don't know for sure. I think one piece was the effort to get projects constructed quickly, to be honest, and that because there was that emphasis, as soon as Corridors of Commerce was passed, MnDOT was talking to its district saying what projects are going to be good candidates for this. And so essentially they started the process of choosing projects before they were able to put the public suggestion process together. And so by the time the public suggestion process was underway, they had already identified a number of promising projects that they thought were good candidates for Corridors of Commerce. So I think that's one piece, is again the effort toward trying to do things as quickly as possible. But I think another piece of it is frankly that MnDOT is used to talking internally to make decisions, and it is not as common for MnDOT to draw in that outside stakeholder component. I will, however, comment that we were very intrigued. I didn't talk about it in the presentation, but we were very intrigued by the Corridors Investment Management Strategy Program. SIMS is the shorthand for it. But that was a very different process in which MnDOT actually assembled a team of people to evaluate projects from multiple different agencies. And I don't remember all of them off the top of my head, but it was like health and tourism and human services and economic development, and all of those different agencies were a part of that evaluation process. So I thought that was an interesting change from the other things that we saw at MnDOT. But as I said, a lot of that is the answer to your question, Representative Hornstein, is to some extent speculation. I'm curious to hear how MnDOT would describe why they did not take those outside suggestions as seriously as they might have.
Just a very quick follow-up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you also believe that this, you described kind of this roller coaster of funding. We had the $300 million in bonding the first year and then less amounts, and then who knows the future. I mean, I feel a dedicated, consistent source of new revenue would help this Corridors of Commerce program. But do you think that these fluctuations had anything to do with some of the problems that you've identified with transparency, because you've got such a pent-up need for these new expansion projects that they're all kind of coming at the agency all at one time, and there just aren't the resources to do it. Why did you kind of identify this I think you describe it as fluctuations as an issue or a problem. Mr. Kircher.
I don't think I identified it as an issue or a problem. I was trying to provide a little bit of background of information on corridors of commerce before I talked about our findings. Frankly, I don't think that MnDOT gets excused from following the criteria and the law just simply because the legislature is giving it different amounts of funding each year. I think it should be aligning what it's doing with the law. Does that make the program a little bit more challenging to administer? Yes, but that doesn't mean that they can't do it in a more transparent way and in a way that reflects the criteria and the process laid out in the law. Okay. I don't see that as an issue.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is about the last recommendation on tracking spending by local governments on trunk highway improvements. Last year, we passed a law that requires the department to set up a cost participation policy with local units of government. Would this be in conjunction with that in any way, or did you look at any aspect of that other than the recommendation that they just need to tell us how much it is?
Mr. Kircher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the question, Senator Jensen. We did not look closely at the cost participation policy, although we did hear about it quite a bit as we were going out and talking to various stakeholders around the state. It has been a source of considerable dissatisfaction with MnDOT by a number of stakeholders. But this particular recommendation is really oriented toward just trying to get a sense of what is actually happening. I think to the extent that just broadly, I think that we ought to be knowing what is being spent. And to the extent that local units of government need to put in some money to make when MnDOT does projects on trunk highways, we should know about that too. We should be able to get a sense of the total overall amount of money being spent and not just focus on what's coming out of the state coffers.
Thank you.
Thank you. Members, if you have questions after this, I'm sure gentlemen will stick around.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your work on this and presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
And we'll have Commissioner Zelli, the department.
Hello, Mr. Chair, legislators. I am Charlie Zelli, Commissioner of the Department of Transportation, and I'm joined by Mark Gieske, who is the Director of Transportation Systems Management, so actually knows in depth some of the answers to many of the questions that are just raised today. I just will say, as a matter of introduction, I really appreciate and actually thank the Office of the Legislative Auditor for the work of this program, but also to highlight what we actually recognize are significant issues before the state of Minnesota and our department. Many of the issues, frankly, just discussed in the last hour are not new to us. In fact, we kind of embrace the idea of bringing more transparency, more of a spotlight on some of these programs. And so we accept the recommendations and generally agree and understand that these are areas that we should be and frankly are addressing as we kind of work through what is a very difficult process. Project selection is just one element. It's a very important element of what we face as a department. Obviously, it has a great deal of interest for all constituencies, certainly for the legislature. There is a host of criteria that goes into choosing projects. I'm 3 years into it, and I'm still studying carefully, and I'm sure many of you are, as to what really is inside that black box. The reality is, as I see it, it's not a great mystery, but it is one where we're trying to solve for many criteria. There's objective criteria, and we've heard about it today. Pavement quality and bridge condition being kind of central, and it is. But there's others, certainly, safety, congestion in the metro or even outside in our regional centers. And yes, the economic health impacts and environmental justice, absolutely critical. As we will learn more, we recognize there isn't enough funding to cover it all. There never will be, but I think the idea of getting more transparency of how we are spending the dollars we have so that they serve the greatest interests of Minnesotans is certainly something that we aspire for. And we know that our role is not just to take care of a system for its system's sake. It's there to promote the economic welfare, the health of our people, the environment, our cities and communities. We talk about the balancing act, and we are definitely in a balancing act. There are local interests, not just units of government, but citizens themselves. And yes, we actually are open and do hear many concerns from both Minnesotans and, of course, from all of you about local projects. We do balance that interest about local projects with statewide systems. Transportation is a series of networks, and it is one system. So we have to be mindful of that balance between the state overall system perspective and that of individual local communities, whether it's the state highway or whether it's the local roads, county roads that come into it. We've talked a lot about expanding the system, and yes, we do see the need for our strategic expansion. We would love to do more, and obviously there is a major crisis in transportation funding. We spend a lot of time talking about it, but part of the problem, of course, is that we are by both federal guidelines developed in the federal reauthorization of MAP 21 in 2012, and frankly, we think it's a good idea to have performance measures where we can objectively allocate funding to preserve the system. But we are not just preserving the system. We are generally modernizing the system, which is totally true that when we are redoing pavements, when we're rebuilding bridges, we are also trying to bring it into the 21st century to help garner benefits beyond just the quality of the concrete, but those wider and important criteria that many of which were discussed just today. So we want to get more directly into the conversation about corridors of commerce or SIMS or some of our general program, but I'll get deeper into it with Mark, and then we'll be open to have the conversation and questions. Let me go forward.
Welcome, Mr. Giesecke, to our committee.
Thank you. My name is Mark Giesecke. I'm the director of the Office of Transportation System Management at MnDOT, which is the office that includes the planning and programming functions for the department. I echo a lot of the things that have already been said. The selection process that we use is, in fact, pretty complex, and understanding it is sometimes easier said than done, but we are very grateful that the Office of the Legislative Auditor did take the time to do that, and it was a great deal of time to help understand that, and we hope that the readers of this report will gain a better understanding of our selection process. And as Commissioner Zelli said, we look forward to implementing these recommendations and to make our process better and more transparent. For starters, we were very pleased that the report affirmed some of the efforts that we've made in the department that we were proud of accomplishing, and we're glad that they were noticed, especially since the 2008 audit. We appreciate the acknowledgement for our nationwide leadership in implementing performance-based planning and the good position that put us into for meeting the MAP 21 requirements. We are proud of our 90% on-time project delivery record over the past 3 years and our implementation of asset management planning. The auditor also expressed some confidence in the quality of the programming decisions that MnDOT made, saying it had no concerns about the decisions themselves, so we're pleased about that. And the improvements made in prioritizing asset preservation projects and the improved consistency between our agency spending priorities found in our long-range investment plan and the projects selected through our standard process is another accomplishment that we were proud of. Again, in general, we agree with the auditor's findings. We're looking forward to implementing them. I'll address each one, and I'll be kind of following along in the form of the letter that's in the back of the report if you wish to follow that. Before I do that, though, I did want to address one thing in particular. This may answer some of the questions about corridors of commerce, or it may just create more, but On page 57 is where those findings of commerce, and there's two findings highlighted on that page. The bottom one is that MnDOT's process for selecting corridors of commerce projects has been inconsistent and subjective. And I won't disagree that it's lacked some transparency and certainly benefit from more of that. The other finding on that page, though, that we were not fully consistent with the law's requirements, I think needs a little explanation, and I think this will get to some of the questions that were asked. The finding says that MnDOT did not evaluate project recommendations from the public as required by the law. In fact, the law does require MnDOT to evaluate only those projects that are found to be eligible. MnDOT exercised its discretion under the law to set a time limit on when projects needed to be started or completed as an eligibility requirement. And so because of that, we only looked at projects that could be begun quickly. Which you've had a good conversation on already. So when we did go out to the public and ask for them to submit ideas, the ideas that were most ready to be delivered as projects were projects that MnDOT had already done some work on. And so outwardly, I can see the perception that projects that were selected were projects that were already known to MnDOT. It's because of that. It's because we were placing such a high emphasis on readiness for that initial year of Corridors of Commerce. We wanted to get a fast start. We wanted to get those projects out quickly. So that hopefully answers that a little bit. The report goes on to state that MnDOT did not use the 7 listed criteria. What we did was that we did produce several different project scenarios prior to commencing the Corridors of Commerce program that used different combinations of those 7 criteria weighted in different weights. We were exploring that, trying to see, you know, what would be a reasonable formula, how would we want to choose the projects that we were going to choose for this program. There is no universally accepted way to evaluate projects, so it's a little bit of a subjective analysis. We looked at all those scenarios and we tried to produce what we thought was the most reasonable results. So of those 7 criteria, what we did was we evaluated and relied upon the return on investment to a large extent, and the table that was noted before in the report, which is just one page back on page 57, that table is actually the report on return of investment rank, which you'll see in the last column. So that's one of the criteria of the 7, and that's what that table is for. Return on investment includes other things in its calculation, like safety benefits, traffic congestion benefits. Those are 2 of the other criteria for Corridors of Commerce. Those do get rolled into return on investment. 2 more criteria were connections to trade centers and freight efficiency, which we felt for the purposes of that first year that those were embodied in the definition of an interregional corridor, which the program is limited to, at least in greater Minnesota. So there was no specific scoring applied to that. It was more considered to be satisfied by the eligibility criteria. The 7th criterion was satisfaction of multiple planning objectives, which also had no scoring method assigned to it. So we understand the lack of transparency, you know, may have led to the perception that we were not following the law, but we are committed to correcting our lack of transparency, so hopefully that will all be resolved. So with that, I'll go through the recommendations. I'll start with key recommendation number 1, which is that MnDOT should increase its transparency of its decision-making process, particularly noting not only what we selected, but what we did not select. The report identified a number of best practices used around the state. MnDOT will implement best practices to improve the transparency in both our standard process and our special selection process. For the special programs have a limited set of candidate projects to look at. They're often a solicitation or in some other ways have a limited pool of eligibility. Those, it's easy to be more transparent. We can evaluate those. We can publicize the ranking criteria in advance so that all will know what constitutes a good project. We'll also evaluate and publicize the scores of all the projects included, including those that were not selected. So in that situation, that is something we can surely accomplish. And Corridors of Commerce would be one of those kind of special programs. In the standard process, there typically is not a solicitation or a pool of candidate projects. Needs for the projects are typically generated from the pavement or bridge management systems or another performance-based criteria, such as safety or maybe congestion. MnDOT will provide greater information on how those systems select or do not select candidate projects and the other factors that MnDOT uses to prioritize among those candidates. So we'll make that available. From some of our local agency partners, the auditor heard some positive stories about MnDOT's sharing of information. We will pick up on those best practices, and we will share those amongst our central office offices and our districts so that we can implement those statewide. I'll group key recommendations 2 and 3 together since they're both about corridors of commerce, about the greater objectivity and transparency, and then reporting on the selection process and the criteria. Corridors of Commerce, as you know, is a new program. Its goal is to enhance economic climate and remove barriers to freight movement. So in our inaugural selection, we did place a heavy emphasis on the time till commencement of the project, but we did not necessarily perform calculations on all the selection criteria that were listed in the law, as I said. MnDOT agrees that the Corridors of Commerce would benefit from greater transparency in the criteria used and how they were incorporated into the selection process. So with that experience that we've gained in the first implementation of the program, MnDOT will be able to adopt more objective criteria for use with future Corridors of Commerce project nominations. So what we'll do, we'll establish clear ranking and scoring criteria. We'll include all 7 of the statutory factors, and if we add any, which we are allowed to add, we'll include those as well with a clear explanation of what those are, what's a valued result of those, and how they'll be calculated or scored or ranked. And we will go back and we'll evaluate all the nominated projects that were eligible, that were nominated before. So we'll go back and we'll score those all with all the criteria so people can see how those rank. And regarding the reporting, the Corridors of Commerce statute already requires a report. And so we would gladly include all of this information on our selection criteria and how we use them in the report. Whether there's a law requiring that or not, we'll just go ahead and do that. Key recommendation number 4 is a little more involved, but it is about limiting the use of project readiness or time to commencement of a project as a project selection method. Specifically, we shouldn't use something less than 3 years. And MnDOT agrees that requirements or expectations to deliver new projects in a very short time may dictate choosing projects differently than we might otherwise have if we didn't have that restriction. And sometimes that causes problems for us and our partners. Moving something up disrupts other priorities, means you have to find money at a different time than you're expecting. It can be a hardship, but quick delivery also has some benefits, and some of those you brought up yourself, benefits to the public and benefits to delivery innovations from MnDOT. So this is how we kind of look at this, and this is some of the different angles to this issue. It takes time to deliver construction projects. Some take more than others. Some projects are more easily accelerated than others. In those cases where there is a deadline to spend new money, the most desired projects cannot be easily advanced in time to use the newly available funds, that we would perhaps look at another alternative, which would be to advance some other projects in its place and use that money to do the project that we were hoping for in a different time, in effect kind of swapping the funds around, allowing us to redirect the money to the projects that were intended without compromising the selection process or incurring the hardships that we might get from accelerating. So that's perhaps one way we could look at it. On the other hand, though, even when not required by the legislature, MnDOT has intentionally tried to select projects that can start quickly to demonstrate that when we get resources, we can do good projects and we can address some of the state of Minnesota's many needs. By doing that, we hope to demonstrate that we could be trusted with the additional new funds. It puts the money out there on the road where the taxpayers can enjoy the benefits, and it avoids those inflationary impacts of letting the money sit in the bank. Accelerating projects can create some project delivery burdens, but MnDOT has already taken a number of steps to try to lessen the burdens of that quick delivery, trying to position ourselves to be ready for that unexpected influx of money. We have a process of identifying shelf and flexible projects. Those are projects that are developed specifically with the intent that they could be advanced if new money became available. We've developed alternative project delivery methods which don't take as long, shortens the time to delivery, so quicker delivery doesn't compromise the selection process, and other plan preparation efficiency kind of projects. So when we do these things, we can respond to that new funding and not suffer all of the consequences of compromising the selection process. So MnDOT does agree with the recommendation that we should only use project readiness as a criteria where it's really necessary or a benefit to the projects. We agree with the recommendation that it's a criterion that should be used to select projects when appropriate, so when it's required by law or when there's a clear benefit or a cost that we can tie to that. And recommendation number five is about directing funding towards projects that create new infrastructure. We should have a planning process that enables us to prepare for such projects. And we agree with that idea, and some of the things that I've mentioned already are putting us on that path. The identification of shelf projects and flexible projects is one thing that we do for that. MnDOT agrees that some planning for future expansion projects would improve transparency for selecting those expansion projects if and when new money does become available. MnDOT's highway investment plan is required by law to be financially constrained, so we won't be putting it in there, but we can nonetheless do some proactive and prudent planning to develop a modest plan that would identify the most important expansion projects, just so that we're ready, and we would develop them to some logical point of readiness so that they could easily be advanced then when the money became available. And the last recommendation, number six, MnDOT should track spending by local governments. We agree with that there's multiple ways that local governments spend money on trunk highways, and we just don't have one way of pulling that all together. It's something we should develop. And that's it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Gaitsky. We do have a few questions. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for coming back, and Mr. Gaitsky. I see that my hometown of Wadena is listed on this this exhibit 3-2 of the corridors of corridors, and it's still down there as low priority. It's been on that low priority for about 30 years. So even though it's in the queue, I'm still not going to hold my breath. That's not why I bring this up, Commissioner. You used a reference, a metaphor, just a little while ago, and I know it's even the auditor's office used it too. It was in regards to you using a black box. I, sir, have to deal with a black box. I'm under the scrutiny of anything under a black box. That's my living. And when I look at some of these slides that come out, we were talking about the problems that the corridors of commerce have. Some of these things, I'm not going to list them all, but where it says MnDOT had added its own criteria and chose its own products based on its evaluation. But it was the last problem that was listed here, sir, where it says MnDOT leadership inserted preferred projects. Now, as a businessman, I'm held accountable as a leader. Is there a list? Because I did not hear the auditor's office list anybody, but is there actually a list of the leadership that would have this kind of responsibility and authority to insert these preferred projects?
Chigisky.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm not aware of a project that was inserted by myself or our leadership, but I defer to Mark, may have know what that was in reference to. I do think that we are learning as we move forward with the Corridors of Commerce program what Mr. Gieske has described, multiple criteria. We did particularly with the first funding, with $300 million, really look toward projects that could be in the ground and provide benefit sooner than later. But what's interesting, if you follow the whole program, some of the more recent rounds of funding, we've actually advanced projects that we have identified as unfunded and we wouldn't finish, but would help create more on-the-shelf ready work, like doing right-of-way acquisition, preliminary engineering. So I think we've evolved, and I think the idea of getting more transparency, when we refer to a black box, it's simply kind of acknowledging that there seems to be mystery, and I think we're trying to take the mystery out of it, that there really are objective, subjective criteria. It's just that there's more than one or two. You'll notice early on, some of the stakeholder engagement is what helped drive project selection beyond just the return on investment. The idea that we had some geographic consideration that it wasn't just Metro, it wasn't just Greater Minnesota. So I think that as we evolve, we want to move more forward to be really clear about why it is we're choosing the projects that we've selected, and that they do tie to some of the seven, or if there is additional criteria, they're ones that should make a good sense to everybody. One of the considerations too we talked about is Corridors of Commerce is all about expansion, but we, of course, are always mindful that when we expand more lanes, they're just more lanes that we'll have to maintain and replace and consider in the future. So always this idea of maintaining a stream of funding to maintain and to strategically expand is what our vision is. And we've talked about it being inefficient to have a lot of funding at once. That's true. We rose to the occasion, but if we had more knowledge and understanding that of a Corridors of Commerce program over many years, we would be able to develop the capacity within MnDOT and also expand those criteria in a more transparent way.
Mr. Commissioner, and a few people have suggested from a funding standpoint that that seems to be throwing a wrench in some of the criteria, and I could not agree with Mr. Kircher any more than when he said, regardless of the funding sources, we should have a set criteria, we should have transparency, it should be objective to the point it can be, and that's why we're sitting here today, because there's confusion in that lack of transparency and in that selection process. So regardless of funding sources at this point in time, I understand that's a big conversation piece right now, but I think it's very, very clear that what we're talking about is criteria and selection. So I guess I would like us to focus on that area because that's why we're all here today. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, and others who have presented here earlier today. A few weeks ago, I took a drive from Mazeppa to Brainerd in southeast Minnesota to approaching north central Minnesota, and I deliberately looked for potholes. I found one pothole the whole way, and that wasn't even a deep one. So it was interesting. Maybe this is getting Mr. Chair off course a little bit, but I think it's important for us to note. I was looking at the graphs on and the associated descriptions on pages 16, 19, and 21. And it appears that, we are finding MnDOT and the state of Minnesota actually doing a better job over each of the 8 or so or 9 years prior to 2014, actually being more on schedule and less behind schedule with their projects. Each of the three road conditions outlined in terms of trunk highway pavement condition outline that each of the three different road categories here are all exceeding the expectations or exceeding the project goals by the department, and each of those three have improved in subsequent years from 2008 to 2014. Similar thing with half of the bridges anyway. Half of the bridges are doing very, very well, proceeding very well and surpassing the goals, with the exception of National Highway System bridges that were pointed out. I'm curious, did we see and can we expect the same improvements and same meeting or actually exceeding the goals for each of these areas in 2015? And then, Commissioner, I'd be interested why we're seeing, and I really believe that the drive for transportation money, as I listen to my constituents and drive the roads around Minnesota, is not driven by the people of Minnesota, but rather by the special interest groups, many of them which are in this room today watching this particular hearing. So I'm curious what your sense is on that. 2015, are we going to see again very good improvements in both the pavement condition and the bridge condition? With that, can you help us identify why do we see this interest group pushing for more and more transportation money when our roads are improving and we seem to be doing a very good job?
Well, thank you for the question, Mr. Chair and Representative Rakowski. There was substantial improvements over since 2008, no question, and also significant amount of investment, most notably the Chapter 152 bonding of, I'll let Mr. Giesecke tell me, but that's over $2 billion that was advanced because of additional revenue that was provided by the legislature in 2008, and from that, a substantial number of bridges were either replaced or repaired. Expanded, certainly pavements and roads. So we've actually brought the system to a better condition. But, of course, that funding, not that we're here to talk about funding, but that will dissipate. So I don't think you'll see in the coming years that same arc of improvement. In fact, you will see it go the other direction. And, in 2000, fiscal year, a couple of years from now, we'll have roughly 60% of the funding we've had in these past few years. So actually, the quick answer is no, we will not see that kind of improvement. In fact, what happens over time is there's deterioration. And when we took that longer frame of planning, there is very little funding available for expansion, additional lanes, interchanges, providing for that strategic expansion. I hear a lot more from constituents, communities, mayors, county commissioners than I hear from industry, suppliers.
Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. And to be fair, you are correct, Mr. Commissioner, that we're not here for this funding debate on either way. So let's continue with our discussion of the auditor's report. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner and Mr. Giesecke, for coming and talking about this. I think some of the concerns we have and it revolves around some of the concerns that our constituents are having. And I have a fellow Highway 14 corridor people that have mentioned Highway 14 before. But one of the challenges we have out there in building the trust and support for continued expansion and continued revenue sources revolves around the history. And Highway 14 expansion has been on the, quote, 20-year plan for the last 40 years and no longer is even on the plan at all. That kind of deteriorates people's trust and willingness to put forth additional dollars. And I think it goes to what we're talking about, transparency, and more specifically the transparency about what isn't getting done. And so for us to help this political process, which we have to support financially, we need to get that trust level back up. And so how do we continue moving forward with programs that are on the expansion list and the growth list that keeps getting pushed back by other programs and other projects when we've identified them in the past and no longer have identified them? How do we deal with that?
Mr. Commissioner, before you answer, I apologize. Members, we are going to go a bit over. We have several people in the queue. Just want to let people know if they do have a place to go. Certainly, we understand that. But if our Senate counterparts are okay with that, we'll continue through the 2:30 hour. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner.
I'll try to be quick, Mr. Chair. As we've been discussed here earlier, the planning program, both the STIP and the MNSHIP, these are the 4-year plan, the 10-year plan, the 20-year plan. These are resource-constrained plans. And certainly when we see the specific projects in the next 4 years, We have to identify adequate funding in order for them to be on the list. That wasn't always so. So that's why Highway 14 fell off the list, because now only those projects to which we have identified funding, and sadly, very few expansion programs are on that regular program. We have taken initiatives, as you suggested, to identify projects that we feel are needed but don't fall into a specific fully funded list, and certainly Highway 14 appears on that list. And also, we've been working on something you may have heard called Next 10. The next is the next 10 years. What are the both rehabilitation, modernization, and expansion projects that we feel are suited for the state of Minnesota? And that is where we have kind of derived at those. But we agree with you with more clarity and more transparency on those projects are something that we will be more, try to be more explicit about.
If I could just expand upon that, basically what you're telling me is that we're basing it upon the funding structures that we know today and from structures that we knew in the past, but that doesn't, that still begs the question, if we had in the past extenuated, believed that in 20 years we could do a project with the funding sources that were there, what has changed, and won't that continue to change always into the future? So don't we have an obligation to our constituency and to the state of Minnesota to put forth the plans and put them in the situation in which we can accommodate our plans into the future? And why don't we provide for that both financially and philosophically as well as administratively? It's a question that I think they are looking for us to answer.
Thank you.
Senator Senjum.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, and all others that have been here today to go through this report, which is a little daunting, and I kind of wish we would have had a day or two to look at it, but that's not the case. And Mr. Chair, at least Senator Dibble, perhaps down the way at some point after we've had a chance to maybe look at it with at least the Senate side, it would be helpful, at least to me, and I'm not sure if I'm going to need it or not, if we could re-review this at some point in time in a month or so.
Mr. Chair, Senator Senjum, absolutely. I take your lead on this stuff, so you just let me know.
So, again, thank you. I guess my question, it was somewhat addressed with Representative Petersburg, but could we go to footnote 7 on page 56, because I'm trying to understand a little bit, and I suppose this is sort of the mystery of the black box. I hate talking about it like that, but about what return on investment is, and as the footnote points out, in the private sector, return on investment is this and that, but then in the so-called public sector, it describes return on investment as something else, and the basis of my question is that myself and several others in this room are going to have to go back to our respective districts, and again, not to reference Highway 14 too much, but Highway 14 seemingly is, from the standpoint of return on investment, almost a hopeless effort from the standpoint of it being low, 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 all the way through the charts. And I'm going to have to try to describe to people why that is the case, because there's a lot of time and effort, money and interest in southern Minnesota on this project, and yet it just doesn't seem to make the grade, if you will, against other competitive projects. And so can you help me a little bit understand what return on investment is from the standpoint of MnDOT and how they come to that conclusion relative to the various projects? Again, I've been told for 10 years at least that Highway 14 and it's not about where I live or anything else, but it's just the case that we get exposed to all kinds of reasons why, from the safety point of view, from the commerce point of view, that there's a powerful need down there. But when it gets up here and gets that assessment, we just don't seem to rank, I guess. And so, again, I'm going to have to go back and explain that, but I just need a little help in terms of your formula versus their logic in southern Minnesota.
Mr. Gieske.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The return on investment is kind of just a common term from private economics. In government, we really don't have a return on the investment, so we use what we call a benefit-cost analysis, which is a little more accurate. So the result of the benefit-cost analysis depends upon what you all consider for benefits. Generally, we would consider safety savings, so a reduction in crashes. We might consider reduction in congestion, reduced trip length, anything that can be monetized and attributed directly to the transportation improvements. Those are what we usually put in. There are other things that can be considered. Economic potential development. Development potential is not something that's generally in there, but that's how you might get different answers and why you might, quite frankly, have different priorities for some programs than others.
Mr. Chair, can I just follow up? And I don't need a long answer, but I heard the answer. In terms of how this all happens, is it a group of people within a room that are assessing return on investment, or is it a computer model, or what would I, if I really saw how that these decisions are made, what would I be looking at, a spreadsheet, or would I be looking at five people in a room that's sitting around a table and says this one's good and not
bad? Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yeah, there is a adopted standard policy practice that MnDOT uses to compute benefit cost analysis, so that's something we could provide for you.
Okay.
And it would take the form of a spreadsheet to see the actual calculations, but yeah.
It's applied consistently.
Right. It's used consistently across all of our uses for benefit costs. Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would have to say I think MnDOT is trying very hard and overall doing a pretty good job, and I certainly appreciate your recommendations and key recommendation number four, because I do believe you have to be able to prioritize and stay nimble. We all know how slow government works and how bureaucratic we can get, so I appreciate that. But your answer in key recommendation number one, MnDOT will implement best practices for transparency and everything else. Well, that's bureaucratic speak there too, and I think we can go a long, long ways to implementing much more transparency with the way these projects are funded and prioritized. Now you have three bullet points there. Can you expand on that? I mean, it does not seem to me that you're really being very concrete about how you're going to increase transparency.
Mr. Gieske.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. After the report was first made available to us and we had a chance to review it, our district engineer from Detroit Lakes sent us a very detailed list of all of the efforts that she makes to make the process more transparent to her local agency partners and public. And we found out from Mr. Kirshner when he did his audit that is actually where the local agencies were most satisfied. And so we do have some very concrete recommendations from her on holding annual meetings with each of your counties and cities and meeting with the area transportation partnerships and publishing things on the website at different times of the year. So there's a relatively concrete list of practices that we have to look at.
Mr. Chair, quick follow-up.
Representative
Ugel. Yes. I would like to see that letter, and I hope that you could maybe copy the rest of us on that, too. Thank you.
Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was looking at page 2 of the auditor's report, the upper left-hand MnDOT spending targets, and there's a considerable fall-off in regional and metro congestion in a few years, and most of it's going into preservation, and that means that we got 1 million more people moving to the metro area by 2033 or thereabouts, and we're not going to be able to do anything about the congestion in the regional area here of the metro area. That seems incredible, but I suppose you're going on current law and funding. Is that what we're looking at there when you're doing your calculations?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chair, yes, that's correct. When we project our revenue, we only project revenue that we know we can get from existing revenue sources. So any one-time funding, such as the chart we were just looking at before, took into account a lot of one-time sources, and that's why things got better. But from there forward, once those one-time funding sources run out, we're only looking at what the current sources would generate.
Representative Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to go back to a question that you asked earlier, and that is, how is it determined that what districts get what funding, and how come there's such a wide disparity about which the funding that seems to be very, well, it's very varied. It seems like it's a crapshoot on who gets what money and what district gets the funding. So how is that determined?
Mr. Giesecke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Districts get their money in two different ways. We divided up the money in terms of the national highway system, which is about 44-45% of our system. Those are the routes that the federal government recognizes as the most important routes in the state. For those routes, we distribute the money where the needs are. So we use the pavement models and the bridge models, the safety records, to determine where those needs need to go. So that money can shift as needs change. The other half of the money is distributed by a formula, and the formula approximates needs, but it's less fluid and it's more predictable for the districts, and they use that for all of their other kinds of investments.
Thank you. Well, Senator Neumann.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I've got a number of questions that at some point I'm going to pose to you. I will save the committee's time today after I've had a better chance to absorb this report. Okay. But the one question I would like to come back to for purposes of this committee is an earlier question that was raised by the representative. And that had to do with the MnDOT leadership inserting preferred projects and MnDOT having a TPIC committee, a leadership committee inserting. Very clearly, the auditor's office has made those findings, and I think I heard you say that there is no list of preferred projects that are being inserted. And if I misunderstood your answer, please tell me. But are you saying then that the auditor has made an erroneous finding regarding the insertion of preferred projects by MnDOT leadership?
Mr. Chair, what I said was I'm unaware of specific projects that were inserted beyond our process. The process itself for Corridors of Commerce was new, and the TPIC, the senior group, which is more a coordinating body where projects from the districts and from both our central office comes to, acts as a bit of a board of directors in terms of making its ultimate recommendations. I think the Corridors of Commerce program, as I mentioned, had a number of criteria, many of which we talked about here this afternoon, like ready to be constructed, shorter lead times, a balance geographically, and then some of the other criteria, like the return on investment and the stakeholder interest. You know, in the case of Highway 14, you know, from a pure return on investment, given current traffic counts, is kind of looking in the rearview mirror, looking backwards. But those of us who appreciate the amount of economic activity that's going along that corridor, the manufacturing base, the trucking, that is really much more like, where do we see freight movements? We know that that's going to be the increased use of roadways in the state of Minnesota, as much as 30% over the next 15 years. So when there's said that there was a senior group inserting it, I'm not quite sure. I'm just saying personally, maybe Mark can answer that. But it is in the context of figuring out this new program. It wasn't coming in at the last minute.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Newman.
Commissioner, the qualifier in your answer is I am not aware, I'm going to make a specific request. Very succinct response is going to be fine with me. Would you please go back and look and see whether or not there is such a list of projects and who's on it, and if so, provide that information to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think what I suggest is we answer right now. I think maybe Mr. Giesecke may know the answer better than I.
Mr. Giesecke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Noting in the report on page 61, is where the auditor had reported on that. There was a project on 694 that was added kind of at the last minute. It was not a project that we had originally considered and scored and ranked with the others, but I do recall that it was added later because there were savings on other projects in the metro area, and there was room to add, a project needed to be added, and this one met the criteria that we had been using, and so it fit the criteria, and it was available, and so it was added by leadership.
Senator. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Gheese, other than the project you have outlined on page 61, are there any other such projects as identified by the Auditor's Commission of MnDOT leadership inserting preferred projects?
Mr. Gieske.
Mr. Chairman, there's no list of important projects that the leadership is holding on to. The one mechanism we have for inserting projects that is different would be our risk register investment opportunity plan, which is really to respond to sudden changes, that something unknown that happens that we couldn't plan for at the beginning of the year. Leadership may choose from amongst those and say, you know, this is important that we address now. I know we didn't plan for it and it wasn't in the program, but it's critical. We discovered hazardous material on a project or something else that caused project costs to go up. They'll react to those, and there's a list of those, but that's the list that only list that I would.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Gheese, the answer to my question is no. Is that correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
And Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I really do want to understand, too, what we're talking about on this transparency issue, and I hope the kind of information you're indicating on return on investment is the kind of transparency that we'll see. Because my understanding is, talking about Highway 14, it was one project, it was all the whole road, and so the return on investment is going to be a lot different and look a lot different if we're taking now the sections that are left and putting it in a list. Is it on a list by state? Is it a list by region? And then what do we then scale down those traffic safety? Because that was the main reason originally, was the safety. So if you're just looking now at 14 miles versus how many started at the original, how could it ever reach not low? How could it ever move up on that? And that's, I want to understand that better, and I hope when you come up with your transparency changes and best practices that it includes that in it.
Mr. Gieske, any comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you bring up a very good point that when Trunk Highway 14 was started, they were looking at a whole corridor. The segments that are left, if you look at them alone, would have a lower return on investment. That's why they're the segments that are left. But we are still facing a situation where we're really focused on preservation, and any expansion just is not in our investment priorities.
Cool. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this is more or less a comment, but feel free to respond as well. I just, in reading the page, I'm sorry, first I should say thank you for coming, and I do appreciate your time, and Commissioner, it's always good to see you. So page 61, it's notable to me that the one project that was chosen, the 694 project, was actually chosen over a project that is actually in my district on Highway 10, the Armstrong Boulevard Interchange. And in addition, that whole corridor on Highway 10 is still in need of a lot of work, in large part due to incredible safety concerns, incredibly high crash and fatality rates along that corridor when compared to highways of other size and capacity. So, you know, one of the things that I appreciate, Commissioner, in your remarks was that you wanted to have more objective criteria, but I guess I'm wondering, as far as safety specifically, more objective, do we need more criteria? Do we need to modify the criteria? And how do you expect that to affect project selection, in particular with working with the local areas? Because I know my folks, my city council, my commissioners are very, very passionate and very knowledgeable, and I think that speaks to the fact that the project got done, Armstrong got done, even though MnDOT didn't choose it. So I'm happy to any response that you have. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, and thank you so much. I appreciate the comment. And also addressing Armstrong, yes, it did get done. And, in fact, it was never lost on all stakeholders, including leadership at MnDOT, that that was a very critical corridor, and it was a larger funding amount, which, as you know, we received TIGRA funding and a number of different funding sources, which really gets to many projects require the puzzle of funding sources comes together from many sources. And the fact that it wasn't a fit for a Corridor of Commerce didn't mean it wasn't an incredibly important project. It just didn't fit that particular time and that particular funding mechanism, and I'm pleased to say we're making progress with it.
And Representative Anderson will give you the last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick follow-up. Just wanted to get some clarification and actually request something from my initial question and following up with the Senator. Going back to this preferred projects, my initial question wasn't actually to identify the projects themselves. My question was I would like to have this, unless the auditor's office is misleading us, but I would like to get a list of the MnDOT leadership that would even have the authority to insert these projects. I'd like to get a list of names and what their positions are, if that's possible.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Anderson, I'm happy to share the organization chart and talk about how the decision-making process works within the organization. Every so often, I remind the organization that they are recommendations to a commissioner, and under statute, is a commissioner's decision. So I will take both the responsibility and the accountability for our program.
Thank you, Commissioner. And members?
Mr. Chair, would you like?
Oh, that's fine.
Sure. Well, I'll just make a couple of comments. I can almost hear the wheels of legislation turning and from the members in trying to help you along maybe with this process and transparency. But on behalf of myself and I'll allow Chair Dibble to speak here too, thank you for being here for Legislative Auditor's Office. We appreciate your time and efforts in this, and I'm sure we will have more conversation, but thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to say something largely similar. This is something a good kind of first crack, and I too, you know, only had my a brief briefing on Friday on the rough outlines of what the audit found, and so I'm still absorbing and digesting. I have to confess, I'm not 100% convinced that we need new legislation, but maybe we do. So I want to entertain that conversation with our committee, because there may be some places where we can button up criteria, expectations, procedures, and processes, that sort of thing. And then, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to reflect for just a moment. As you know, we lost Congressman Szabo on Sunday, and we had a little tribute to him. He's my constituent, as is his daughter, former State Senator Julie Szabo. And you know, everyone's very familiar with his work as a congressman, but you know, he spent a number of years from 1960 on to the time he was elected to Congress in the state legislature. And one thing he major contribution he did was to professionalize this legislature, to allow us to have the ability to examine and study and analyze policies and fiscal matters. And his contribution was national in reach and scope. He was a part of the foundation and formation of the National Conference of State Legislatures, for example. So we wouldn't even have an opportunity like this to have a professional staff that does this kind of deep depth analysis and brings this kind of information forward to us prior to that time that he served with a bunch of other legislators who also thought it was on a bipartisan basis serves our representative democracy's interest in the legislature's role in oversight and accountability. And it, I think, did a lot to make state legislatures and state policy making relevant on a national scale, but also help kind of balance the relative separation of powers, balance the powers here in the state of Minnesota, especially relative to the executive branch. So I just wanted to reflect on that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Senator. Very well noted. Members, with that, we will look for a posting. We've been discussing the conference committee getting back together. We're looking at Wednesday, possibly, so this week, and we would walk through a side-by-side. And so look for that posting. And for House members, we will go into recess because we will meet back here about 15 minutes after session to go over the real ID bill. So this committee is in recess. Good afternoon. Welcome back. We will call the meeting back to order. All right. And some housekeeping first. I want to look at the minutes from both February 15th on our joint committee. Representative Sanders, have you had time to review those minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'll move the minutes from February 15th.
Representative Sanders moves the minutes February 15th. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Those minutes are approved. And Representative Sanders, also April 23rd, 2015.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll move the minutes from April 23rd.
Representative Sanders moves the minutes of April 23rd, 2015. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Those minutes are passed. All right. And wonderful. Okay. And a couple other things to highlight. I would like, at this point in time, our pages, we have more than one page right now. Could you come down and introduce yourself and just one today?
Thank you. My name is Sean Reibel. I am a 2014 graduate of St. John's. If there are any Tommies in the room that need to have a chat with me, I'll meet you out in the hallway. This is my first position with the House. I'm really excited to be here. I'm also paging for higher ed, Greater Minnesota, and property tax. So, thank you.
Great, welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And also, we have a new committee assistant, Josh Anderson, is with us. Josh? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Hi, everyone. Josh Anderson. I'm a 2014 graduate of Southwest State University in Marshall, Minnesota, born and raised in Springfield, Minnesota, which is Brown County. Representative Paul Torkelson's my state representative. So happy to be here at the committee, happy to be working with Chairman Kelly, and looking forward to a good session. And Representative Nash is my other member as well. Also looking forward to working with him.
Thank you, Josh. And finally, our new representative on the committee, Representative Chad Anderson. Chad, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chad Anderson, wife and four kids, ages 6, 4, 3, and 1, so I stay busy with that. Just excited to be on this committee and really excited to be here at the Capitol.
Welcome, Representative Anderson. We're very excited to have you with us. All right, on to the agenda of today. We will be hearing House File. Do we have a House File? 1732. Representative Smith. Representative Smith. Would you like to make some opening comments?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I have a delete all amendment to House File 1732.
Representative Smith, I understand that would be an oral amendment.
Or no, he has a delete all.
You have delete all amendment. Okay. Okay. So I will move the DE1 amendment to House File 1732 to get that in the place that the author would like that. Yes. Getting a little feedback. As I said, I'll move the DE1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. And motion carries. And Representative Smith, do you also have an oral amendment?
I do, Mr. Chair. Shall I walk through that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Please.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the delete all everything amendment as follows. Page 3, line 1, delete everything after the number 2. Page 3, line 1, delete everything after 2. In addition, page 3, line 10, delete everything before the period. And then finally, page 3, delete the entire subdivision 7. And then amend the title accordingly.
Thank you, Representative Smith, and I believe we'll have Mr. Burris walk us through that.
Mr. Chair and members, the first one is a slight modification. It would be page 3, line 9, delete everything after 2. Page 3, line 10, delete everything before the period. Page 3, delete subdivision 7.
Everyone like that read again? We'll do that one more time, please, Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair and members, page 3, line 9, delete everything after 2. That's the number 2. Page 3, line 10, delete everything before the period. Page 3, delete subdivision 7.
Are there any questions on that?
Actually,
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do I understand this then that this on 3.10 and 3.11 stay this? The commissioner may not expend state funds remains in the bill?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Any other clarification on the oral amendment? Okay, I will move that oral amendment then. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Same sign. Amendment passes. Representative Drazkowski.
Mr. Chair, just wondering, maybe for the author, on line 3.10 as amended, the word other, is that kind of an extraneous word at this point? Can that go away, Representative Smith?
Mr. Chair, members, the... I believe that it could, and I hesitate to take it out now only because we're working closely with the Senate. A similar bill has passed through the Senate with that word in, and there is a lot of discussions with the Senate about trying to match the language, and I'm open to taking that word out, although I have not discussed that with the Senate author specifically, but I'm willing to do so before the next stop.
Members, the next stop would be government operations, so if this does pass through here, that's where this is headed.
I believe, Mr. Chair, I believe it's going to Ways and Means.
Yeah, we don't have to go back because they took their rulemaking out.
I stand corrected. Thank you. We'll go to Ways and Means. Okay. All right, with that, Representative Smith, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. As I mentioned, this bill has similar language that has been working through the Senate. I've been working very closely with the Senate in having a bill that has broad bipartisan support to start in phase one, or part one, if you will, of the Real ID bill. Specifically, this bill gives authority and direction to the Department of Public Safety concerning the Federal Real ID Act. It provides directing and department to begin planning, specify various planning activities, requiring a legislative report, which is due at the end of this month, March 31st, on planning and implementation analysis. It limits the use of state funds strictly to the planning piece of it. It directs the department to seek an extension that would lift current federal restrictions on the use of Minnesota-issued driver's license and ID cards to enter federal facilities and government federal facilities and also military facilities as well. Also requires department to provide testimony, information, and fiscal notes related to Real ID. And lastly, it repeals the current Real ID prohibition. As I mentioned, this is step one in the process. This bill simply allows planning and ideas to be discussed for a second bill that will be forthcoming at some later date.
Thanks, Rep. Smith. We do have some questions. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward. I just have a question that relates to the oral amendment. And in subdivision form, and it may be just for council, if you can't answer it, but it's my understanding that the commissioner, the DPS commissioner, will still retain some authority on driver's license. There's broad authority. I think it's Section 171 under, you know, that deals with driver's license. Is that also stopped in this amendment?
Mr. Burris, would you like to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, yes, Chapter 171 of the statutes lays out the driver licensing provisions, and within that, the commissioner has authority around administering driver's licensing requirements of how the program is administered, and there are a couple of provisions in that chapter on rulemaking. And I would read this bill as being silent as to the rulemaking and administrative powers that exist under that chapter. So this is more specific to the planning and implementation activities related directly to Real ID.
So, Mr. Chair, and so that is concerning because if it's silent, then I don't know if we've actually done perhaps what the author really wants to do here, because there still may be some ability to expend funds. Would that be correct, Mr. Burris, even with this revised language?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, on implementation of or administration of driver licensing generally, the statutes hold. This is more, there is a provision here narrowing the use of state funds for Real ID. So I think it's reasonable to expect the department to view this as curtailing their use of the state appropriations for driver services to just the planning activities that are listed out in that subdivision 2.
Okay. Of the Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make sure we had that clarification record here.
Thank you, Representative Hornstein. Representative Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't know what I'm looking at here, but I've got something that tells me we're spending $60 million on this plus. Am I correct, or are we authorizing that amount of money, or how much are we authorizing for this thing?
Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, currently the Department of Driver and Vehicle Services in the Vehicle Services budget area receives $30.7 million a year from a special revenue fund from fees for driver services, and that's just for the sort of day-to-day operations of driver services. And what Subdivision 4 refers to is that those funds would be available for the activities lined out in this legislation.
Well, Mr. Chairman, why are we spending $60 million to change over to a different type of driver's license? Or is this for does this cover everything in the whole world that we're going to do with this, or what? That seems like a lot of money. I don't know. That's why I'm asking.
Mr. Lee.
Mr. Chair and Representative Earhart, no, the $60 million over the fiscal 16-17 biennium is to run driver services. It's not specific.
It's not to this specific for this. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Representative Lucero. Representative Juskowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the author's diligence in communicating with the Senate author going forward. I'm still troubled and curious about the word other. I'm wondering if Mr. Burris could kind of tune us into that there, too. The way I read it, it may imply to the department that they have somehow inherently some sort of ability to spend funds with the existence of the word other there. It seems to me that they may take that to mean that they inherently already have some sort of authority. Mr. Burris?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the interpretation of that would really be on the department. My reading of it is first that the term was originally in the context of rulemaking being part of what was authorized under the delete all amendment, and so eliminating the rulemaking, as you had raised earlier, raises a question about what other really means in the context of this section. Setting aside the department's existing statutory authority on driver licensing administration, there could potentially be a window here for the department to view other implementation as providing some leeway on use of state dollars. On the other hand, the context of that whole subdivision is to limit the department's capability to expend state dollars. So I'd really defer to the department to respond to how they would view the language if it were enacted as it currently reads.
Representative Joskowski.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Burris, that's what I would be afraid of. Thank you.
Representative Runbeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have this overview here of what the program is, but I wonder if Representative Smith, could you just, I mean, how are things going to be better, I guess, if we go to this new license, driver's license, and what documents, I mean, are we, as we go and renew ours, going to have to produce, you know, those of us who've had driver's licenses, are we going to have to produce a lot of new documentation, or just what is the burden on normal people to have a real ID compliant license?
Mr.
Chair, Representative, those questions cannot be answered with this bill, for this bill does not deal with what the new licensing requirements for the state will be. That is an issue for after this bill becomes, hopefully becomes law, and the 2009 session law becomes is repealed. At that point, different ideas will be discussed, and the types of documents and what the impact of that is for our citizens of Minnesota, as well as for the department, would be better spoken to at that point.
Hmm. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions for members? Okay. Representative Joskowski.
Mr. Chair, can the department come up and take questions? Are they here?
We do have a couple of testifiers that we're going to hear first.
I'm sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yep. Any other questions at this point in time from members? Then we have Representative Hornstein.
I'm not one of these, like, you know, real process stickler on the rules type of people. However, I was just shown that I've never really done this before. Under 4.16, bills affecting government data practices, it seems like this might have some, you know, impact on that. And so is there a reason why we're just going right to Ways and Means rather than civil law?
Yeah. I guess the word that we got, Representative Horstein, is that civil law didn't request it. And so I guess that's where we...
Okay.
That's where we're taking direction from.
I always wanted to do that. So.
All right. So noted. You are now on record.
Yeah.
You can run on that now.
Yeah. The rule.
Okay. At this point in time, the Chamber of Commerce, Ms. Borline, please. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Laura Bordelon with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. We wanted to express our support for the bill and for the efforts by the working group to have Minnesota driver license become compliant with Real ID. I don't have extensive testimony, but do appreciate the work going forward for the state to be in compliance.
Thank you, Ms. Bordelon. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for testifying. My question is, it would seem to me that there could be some issues with the current license structure, that it can limit access to federal buildings and certainly military bases. Do you see an advantage for Minnesota Commerce in having that access, and is that the basis of your support?
Ms. Bordelon.
Mr. Chair and Representative, that is correct.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And then my follow-up question would be, In the interest of the chamber, or in the interest of that sort of commerce, is there value in moving this faster rather than slower, both this bill and then also the other, the second bill that will be coming?
Ms. Bordelon.
Mr. Chair and Representative, we do support the efforts by the legislature to move this along quickly. We are supportive of this vote for planning purposes and are hopeful that the Minnesota driver's license will become compliant as soon as possible.
Yeah. Any other questions? Thank you, Ms. Bordelon. Is Ms. Braze here? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Good evening, Mr. Chair. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And we have long been concerned with Real ID because we look at it as a national ID card. It has 100 federal requirements that are attached to it. And so we don't look at it as a state ID or an additional kind of a state ID, but actually a national ID card. So this particular bill calls for the allowing the planning, and we look at planning for Real ID as simply the first step towards that national ID card. Now, if the planning were simply about research or looking into, you know, what entailed, that would be different. But if you're actually planning for implementation, that causes us a concern. So I can't remember who mentioned the money. Over here, mentioned the money. So we did look at the money, and the Chicago Tribune mentions that in Illinois it's going to cost $50 to $60 million to implement the Real ID system. And so we certainly hope that when you get a fiscal note, you'll have a note that tells you the actual cost of doing so. I would like to draw to your attention for the privacy concerns that there is a long list, about 2.5 pages worth, called the Privacy Coalition. It is left and right leaning groups that are all concerned about it being a national ID card. Additionally, in the rules, it talks about there having to be a hub, a federal hub, and then there has to be state-to-state exchange. So the database that has to be created under the federal law is a database that all states, other states, must have access to, as well as the federal government, leading, of course, to the possibility of a significant risk of hacking into this new database that will have all this new all this identification information. In addition to that, we're concerned, even though it mentions that you're going to look at the single track, so Real ID and nothing else, or dual track, where you will have both Real ID and you'll have a regular state ID as an option, we're concerned that once you move in that direction, and because of the cost of having a dual system, that you won't actually keep it. And so the privacy concerns that we have about the Real ID, there won't be any option in order to even drive a car in this state other than to have the Real ID. Former DHS Secretary Michael Chertoff in 2008, which was 3 years after the Real ID passed at the federal level, he described his vision of using Real IDs, and he said it would be to cash a check, hire a babysitter, board a plane, or engage in countless other activities. And that, Mr. Chair, is our concern, because we know that the law says that the Secretary of Homeland Security is allowed to decide what the purposes are. So the law actually says that the Secretary can expand the purposes of Real ID at will. Doesn't have to go back to Congress, can just decide. Now, from our organization as a health freedom organization, what we realize that that means is that we could end up with the Real ID being our national patient ID. And there is a law called HIPAA that requires a unique patient identifier already. But in 1999, there was a law passed at the federal level that forbids funding for it. So we look at this as a backdoor to a national patient identifier, a no card, no care. kind of a process. And if you've ever been to the doctor recently, you'll see that some of the doctors are asking you for your card. They're asking you because of the federal red flags regulation that at one point they thought they had to follow, and a 2010 law said that they don't, but they're still doing it. So we expect that we would not be able to access care without it being tracked through this Real ID. So the last thing that I'd like to say is that the U.S. Constitution says that the state cannot be commandeered by the federal government in order to implement and fund a federal law. Real ID is a federal law, and the reason that we are 11 years past the 2005 enactment of this law is because there are no penalties for the state of Minnesota. And if you took it to the U.S. Supreme Court, they would say the federal government, they'd likely say that the federal government has to fund and implement its own law and issue us all a national ID card called Real ID. So this is essentially a way to get Minnesota to not let the people of Minnesota understand that it is a national ID card, all under the federal government, all under the federal regulators, and to have the state of Minnesota and taxpayers actually fund this process. Now, one thing you just need to know about flying and the threat that you can't fly is that the Homeland Security already told the state of Illinois that their citizens would be able to fly. It's just that they would need additional security checks. In addition to that, the Department of Homeland Security says on their fact sheet that enhanced driver's licenses can be used instead. They can be used to board a plane. Minnesota has an enhanced driver's license. So we look at the threat as a way to try and get you to do what states do not have to do and do not have to fund. So we are opposed to it, and we're opposed to a national ID. And to Representative Hornstein's comment about civil law, absolutely should go to civil law, and we are very surprised that civil law and data practices has not asked for this, because it is a significant concern, particularly the hub and the databases that have to be created, the national connected system of databases. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Sanders? You're on the list? Okay. Representative Hartz or Representative Earhart?
I have a question first for you or counsel. Mr. Chairman, do we have a deadline on this, getting this passed yet? There have been something mentioned a couple of times, but do we actually have a deadline when this has to be done? Does anybody know
this
about
particular bill?
No, the Real ID. Issuing the certificate that lets us get on airplanes.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, there are a couple of dates that the U.S. Department of Homeland Security has expressed for how they're going to handle the next couple of stages with enforcement of the requirements for, you know, acceptance at federal facilities is already in place. So the next date is January 22nd, 2018, and that's the date when TSA is not going to accept identification issued by a state that's not either Real ID compliant or operating under an extension. So that wouldn't, as a sole form of identification, wouldn't be accepted starting in 2018. The second date is October 1st of 2020, and that's the date that DHS has indicated is the kind of hard date, that no more extensions would be available starting then, so that for IDs to be accepted and on federal facilities that are secured, as well as for boarding aircraft, the identification would need to be Real ID compliant.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I was going to ask the witness. I didn't realize this time zone had spread out. I thought we were in a much shorter window here. So what do we do? How do we get on planes after 2018 or 2020 if we don't have this device, the certificate, or whatever we want to call it?
So, Mr. Chair, great. And Representative, I'm sorry, I have forgotten your name.
I have that same trouble myself.
Okay, then. I'm in good company. So, several things. Again, the department told the Chicago Tribune, but the state of Illinois, that people would still be able to get on planes. It's not that they wouldn't be able to get on planes. It would be that they would have additional security requirements. And again, the Homeland the Department of Homeland Security says in their fact sheet that the enhanced driver's license also works. And Minnesota is one of five states with an enhanced driver's license. And the last thing is this right here from Homeland Security, where the fourth stage of enforcement, number four, is called the aircraft acceptable only with second form of ID, which is to be implemented no sooner than 2016. So as long as you have a second ID, and it doesn't have to, you can go on a plane. It's not like you have to have a real ID to go on a plane. This is why I have said that this is just a threat that the department has said, but they can't actually enforce.
Thank you. I think we've strayed far from this bill, so I'm going to get us back on track. I understand there's a member of the public that would like to testify. Is he still here?
Mr. Chairman?
Just stepped down.
I had people come home from California particularly to file for the other ID so that they could travel after January 1, because that was the word at that time, and that was what everybody spread around. I don't know why we can't openly talk about what the hell is the date and what is the penalty. But, I mean, I had people call me from California, two families out there, came home early from their vacation so they could get the special ID, and then they could go out of town on January, which was all a big hoax.
I appreciate it, Representative Earhart, but what you did hear from Mr. Burris, there's the dates definitely have been pushed back to that 2018 time period. What we're talking about here in this legislation is a repeal of the 2005 law. So I think those that answer in itself should help your constituents who have those questions.
Too late. They already came home and did the whole thing, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is related to your comment that Mr. Burris, that's true for getting on an airplane. Is it also true, have the dates been extended for getting onto a military base or into a federal building? And the reason I'm asking is I have a constituent who was unable to visit her son on a military base because she didn't have the right ID, and I was wondering if that was handled appropriately.
Representative Johnson, you would still need to use a passport to get into those facilities. Is that correct? You can get in, but now you're required to use a passport. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, yes, right. DHS had several stages of enforcement of what types of secured federal facilities would require a real ID compliant form of identification or identification issued by a state that had an extension. So there was a series of stages, and so Minnesota, as not having an extension and not having a real ID compliant license, is one of those states where just the ID or driver's license is not accepted to get onto military bases or enter secured federal facilities currently. And just to Representative Earhart's question earlier, some of the communication last fall and information in the media was not entirely accurate from what I had seen. At that point, DHS had indicated that sometime after January 1, the airline requirement would kick in, and they subsequently delayed that. And that's the new dates is now 2018.
Thank you.
Thank you for the clarification. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the committee record.
Yes, Commissioner Chairman Kelly, my name is Tim Nolan, Senate District 65. Former Senate 61, Frank Hornstein was my representative. I'm here today on behalf of We the People. The one on page 2 of the handout here, the statement, I'll go to matter for the record, source of identification on last opportunity to ensure people who are there to say they are or not to check whether they are terrorists. When I was ran for mayor of Minneapolis in 2005, somebody asked the question. I said, sad but true, since 9/11, everyone has become a suspect. I heard already in the record about the cost factor. Why, what another layer of security does this country need? that the alleged 19 terrorists are in that commission, had 12, had nothing, were not anywhere in sight. But also, the detainees in Guantanamo have been held there long overdue. There's more priorities for the millions of dollars that are put in the set that we can put back into education and health education. Because we always seem to find money for war, but we never find money for health and education to make us a prosperous nation and a healthy nation. Furthermore, since 9/11, when my working years, I was a mound firefighter. I was also arson and fire marshal. I became suspicious of the surroundings, and I'm also one of the very few members of the National Firefighters that want 9/11 truth. Because we want, we want the truth, the really true facts. We want to have disclosed the 28 pages redacted in the 9/11 Commission report. Because I took the oath as a Marine, I took the oath as a firefighter. All around the room here took that oath that we have to protect. Who are the enemies? And there's just other priorities we have to get in line. I also concern about my medical records, which has already been stated in the record. If I have two labels on my medical records, I've already met and challenged the one, and I went on to the other. In cyberspace, I've already had my checking accounts has been attacked 3 times just this past year. Back in March of 2002, I had identified my credit cards were stolen, and because the police did a thorough report, I had to go to court. I challenged Capital One. I beat them in one court and went to another court. But getting together, we already are a safe country. We have more military than any other country. We have more military bases. We have over 900 bases across the globe. I'm hoping this stays in the same focus. I don't want to sound like I'm all over the map, but I think we have a surplus in the budget. Why spend more money to have another layer? We already had, since I had my driver's license stolen back then, I lobbied and got the one. Now we have the picture ID. If you ever have your license stolen, just given a new number. Because prior to that, the number stayed the same no matter whatever. But I had the regulation. If I ever get stopped, they had to show 3 picture IDs. But I just, and again, as far as the fact that we the people, and you people representing the people, that we've got to get the focus back awake. We have surveillance since 9/11, the 2 growth industries, surveillance and security, TSA, every cameras, surveillance cameras. It's a growth industry. I love to have stock in that situation. It's a company right here in St. Paul. But anyway, I'm very frustrated. Having been a firefighter, 343 of my brothers are still screaming for justice. The crime scene of the century, Governor Giuliano cleared the wreckage. Somewhere my brothers are some in landfill or on a barge that went off to China. But anyway, I thank you for your time and get the focus back on the people. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there anyone else in the audience from the public who would like to testify on House File 1732?
Did he vote for you?
All right. And to Representative Duskowski's question, is there anyone from DPS here? I do not see anyone. Representative Duskowski. Are there any other?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Duskowski.
Was DPS aware of the meeting?
I believe they were.
Wow. I've got some more questions, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. Representative Duskowski.
Thank you. And this might be for the author and also for Mr. Burris. Lines 1.18 and 1.19 of the bill, we will no longer need the words under subdivision 7. And those could be eliminated, I believe.
We need Gary Liz.
I don't think we need.
And then
we remove 7.
I'm wondering if the author would entertain removal of those words, or maybe he needs to check with the Senate author too, but
Mr. Burris, since we removed subsection 7, would that be appropriate,
Chair,
to remove that language?
Mr. Chair, I think that would be a technical clarifying change if the committee wanted to take up that amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd move to on line 1.18 delete the word under, and on 1.19 delete the word subdivision, and the number 7 I think that's it. Or whatever else Mr. Burris would add to that.
I think that's the only reference to subsection 7. First, I believe in 7.
And Mr. Chair, maybe a question for Mr. Burris as we're doing this. Do we even need that item?
That item being
that item II there.
1.18.
Correct.
Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski. The effect of that item is to direct the department to identify how Minnesota currently isn't compliant from the standpoint of its administrative rules. So including this would have the department identify and report back on what kind of anticipated rulemaking they would undertake if authorized to fully implement. So there would be
like
substantive information that the legislature would receive.
Yeah. Okay.
So the oral amendment would be to take out on 1.18 under and on 1.19 subdivision 7. That'd be correct. No, because... That be your understanding, Representative Drazkowski?
Yes, sir.
Okay, Representative Drazkowski moves an oral amendment that would remove on 1.18 word under and on 1.19 subdivision 7 :. Any questions? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Same sign. The motion passes. More questions?
Mr.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, Mr. Burris, on line 1.24, the words "or seeking implementation guidance." I just wrote a note here. It says, "What is this?" Mr. Burris, can you give us some context on what that means?
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, the determining what kinds of changes might be necessary to both statutes and rules, I would read that seeking implementation guidance directive to be a component that, or a provision that would direct the department to be in contact with DHS about what aspects of statutes and rules currently would need to be changed in order for the state's ultimate compliance package, assuming that's submitted, to be accepted. So, you know, there are a couple of issues that we've identified through the working group process that are likely necessary changes in statute and possible necessary changes in administrative rules. There's the potential that DHS would take a slightly different interpretation and might, you know, indicate one way or another as to whether some changes were necessary in order to meet compliance or not. So this would this provision would provide something to the department to communicate with DHS about and what those aspects and details are.
Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Burris. One other question, Mr. Burris. The bill directs the department to undertake planning activities and then says that by the 31st of this month, which would be, you know, 20 days from now or so, less than 20 days, that they would issue a report. Am I reading the way this is put together, that the report to the legislature may not be the entire planning, may not contain all the planning information that they do? It may be just a sampling, if you will, of what the department has done or understood about these items at that point in time. That's kind of how I read it. Or I'm just wondering what the relationship is between their overall planning effort in the bill and the report on the 31st. Whether that's going to be a complete report and they will have it all done and we'll see everything that they've done in the planning and that's the end of their planning and we're going to see the end of their planning and everything included in that report, or whether we're just going to see what they've learned up until that point, realizing that maybe there will be more going on beyond that. So I'm not sure which of those two it is.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Drazkowski, I imagine it's something somewhere in between those two. I'm hesitant to speak too much for the department because, again, it would be on, it would, you know, this is a directive to them, and they would go with, they would, you know, take this language and proceed. But I think it's reasonable to expect that by the end of March, the department will not have completed all of its planning efforts related to Real ID. That is a very compressed time frame to produce all of the information, get all of the guidance, go through all of the steps that are probably involved with Real ID. So, from that standpoint, it's likely a snapshot that would come back to the legislature at the end of March. The reporting directive does specifically call out that each of the planning items should be included. And if the department were to come back with a report that said we've not commenced, we have no information regarding items 2, 3, or 4, the legislative response would presumably not be especially positive. So I wouldn't anticipate the department to be too thin on that, but at the same time, I don't know how much information they will be able to assemble in this kind of time frame.
Representative Sanders, to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Drazkowski. Subdivision 6, I think, should provide some extra comfort that upon request of a House committee or Senate committee, the Commissioner of Public Safety or their representatives have to appear before legislative committees. So, you know, I think actually there's some great language in here that allows us to call the department in basically at our request to get updates on planning and fiscal impacts.
And in that regard, we are reminded, Representative Drazkowski, since you were inquiring about the department being here, if we pass this bill, then they could be here. So this repealer would allow them to be there. The current law forbids them to be here doing any work on the Real ID. So that's why the DPS would not be here and would not be able to comment on this in regards to any Real ID work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I find that interpretation very interesting. I mean, this is a committee hearing, and we're simply looking at legislation. So I don't know. I just think it's past 5 o'clock, and, you know, it's time to check out. I don't know what... I don't know what's going on here. Mr. Chair, I don't know how we can proceed with this bill without the department here. There's a lot of questions unanswered. I don't know what the timeline is for this bill, but we may want to hold it over and make certain the department's here and that we hear from them on this, because this is a committee that will hear that information.
Well, Representative Drazkowski, I do believe, though, that is the conundrum we are in, because the 2005 law actually forbids them. I think if you talk to Mr. Lee, he can't get a fiscal note because DPS cannot assist in that regard. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and members, I have not requested a fiscal note on this legislation, but I would assume that the statute that would govern the legislature receiving fiscal notes from agencies and the session law that forbid DPS from planning may be in conflict there. So,
right. But I think that's the bill in front of us is the way we're viewing it, is simply a repeal of that so that we can get to the questions that we're all asking and get to that stage, would be my interpretation.
Well, Mr. Chair, just an observation, it would be the most strict adherence to the law that I've seen a government agency in this state ever ever comply with.
Then you would be very excited to hear that, wouldn't you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Smith, closing comments.
Mr. Chair, members, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Thank you. I will move House File 1732 as amended. be referred, passed and referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor? Any discussion, I guess? Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion carries. Another committee day. Members, we will be meeting Wednesday, 12:45 in the basement. Do we have a session?
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Okay. With that, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.